Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
And the Office of the Massachusetts State Treasurer. The Unclaimed Property Division is holding unclaimed funds from medical bills, uncashed paychecks, savings accounts, and more. To see if you have unclaimed money, you can visit findmassmoney.gov.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. We'll open the lines to hear from you about the double standard for women in public life after a celebrated Canadian news anchor was fired at 58 for letting her hair go gray. And then there's Don Lemon's comments about Nikki Haley at 51 being past her prime. Then it's Amber Payne, editor-in-chief of The Emancipator, joining us to commemorate the one-year anniversary of the newspaper's relaunch and to discuss equity or lack of it in America.
I'm Marjorie Egan. The war in Ukraine has upended global energy and food supply markets and left hundreds of thousands of people dead and displaced. The Ground Truth Project's Charlie Sennett joins us live at the Boston Public Library for a special segment on this day, marking 1 year since Russia's brutal invasion. All that ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are live at the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and at facebook.com/GBHnews. Hello, Jim.
Hey there. Do you know what day this is? And by the way, do not say it is National Tortilla Chip Day. But other than National Tortilla Chip Day, what is it, Marjorie Egan?
It is the anniversary of our 10th day at WGBH.
That's
been here
pretty
for 10
incredible.
Years.
Boston Public Radio.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now
thank
this,
you. Thank you.
And by the way, at 2 o'clock, we're going to be serving three beautiful cakes from Flower Bakery.
We are.
Joanne
I'm so
Chang.
Excited.
So if you want to help us celebrate the 10th anniversary or you just want free food, get here in advance 10 o'clock. We're going to talk more about this at the end of the show, you and I. But just to start things off, is there one memory that sticks with you? By the way, we were in commercial radio for like, what, 15 years before that, but this is sort of the thing for
yeah,
us.
Yeah, this
what
is sort away? Of the high point, no question
I
about it.
I would say that. So what do you take away? What's the major takeaway?
Well, the question one? I get asked constantly, Jim, I was just asked it this morning by several people,
oh, really?
Actually, two or three people. They said to me, Marjorie, how do you do it?
Yeah.
With Jim.
Okay.
That's what
Marjorie's
they say.
On a radio show. When we were on our own station, she was on a radio show when WRKO used to have non-lunatics
yep.
as their hosts. I'm listening to the show. We just started working together.
Even then.
Here's what the host of the show says, verbatim, I'll never forget this. Says, you know, I love you, Marjorie. You do great work. How can you even bear to be in the same studio with Jim Browdy? And there was a long pause, and I knew she'd defend me. Her words verbatim were, he's not that bad. So X number
well,
of years
Well, it's been consistent,
later,
Jim. It's been very consistent over the years.
Happy
know what I mean?
10th anniversary. And again,
to you
we'll,
too.
We'll talk more about it. And thanks to all the people at GBH and the listeners who made this all happen.
Yeah, that's right. They hired us, Jim.
They did.
Thank
it's amazing.
God.
And they haven't fired us yet. So
not
it's
yet.
Also pretty beautiful.
Not yet.
Don Lemon is back at CNN after intense blowback to a sexist comment he made about GOP presidential candidate Nikki Haley's age. She's 51. And he said she was not in her prime. There's also the case of the celebrated Canadian TV news anchor, Lisa LaFlemme, fired at age 58, she says, after stopping dyeing her hair and letting it go gray. A couple of days ago, well, actually a lot, you and I have talked on the show about age and fitness to serve in relation to whether 80-year-old President Joe Biden ought to run again. What we said was, we have great respect for the job he's done, we just don't think he should run again. Meanwhile, a 51-year-old Republican woman candidate isn't qualified, she's not in her prime, and a newscaster like Lisa LaFlemme isn't fit to read the news because her hair is gray. So we're opening the phone and text lines, 877-301-8970. Is there a double standard? That's a stupid question. There is a double standard when it comes to women, hair, and age. Is it getting better? Why is it okay, for example, for, let's say, Wolf Blitzer, oh, and me, for example, to go gray?
That's right.
Why is Anderson Cooper a silver fox, but Lisa LaFlemme gets canned? The number's 877-301-8970.
You may have noticed, Jim.
What?
I'm not going gray.
Oh, that's not your natural hair color?
Oh, boy. I mean, no, I have been coloring my hair for quite some time now, and I think a lot of women, once you get past 50, start coloring their hair. Lisa Laflamme was prematurely gray. She started coloring her hair in her 20s. And if you see pictures of her, she is a gorgeous woman, 58 years old. She was highly rated and one of the big stars up in Canadian TV. You know, she went to Afghanistan. She went to Iraq. She would take her nice and easy with her and dye her hair in the toilets in Afghanistan because she was really, her whole head was gray and in these bunkers in Baghdad and stuff like that. She replaced a man who was 77 years old. But she's out.
Well, he was in his prime at 77.
He was in his prime at 78. So absolutely, there's a double standard. I mean, there's a huge double standard for women on television. And you know what? There also is a double standard of women in politics. Remember how Hillary Clinton was attacked over and over again for looking old, for looking even on MSNBC. People talked about her cankles. Remember that she had thick ankles?
So did a colleague of ours. Well, but on the other hand, because I would argue it's getting better. It's not good enough. It's getting better. Do you remember when Catherine Clark, the second-ranking Democrat in the House of Representatives from Revere, let her hair go gray? She wrote a piece talking about how people literally were saying, you're never going to pass legislation again. You're never going to be effective. You're never going to be successful. So one would argue, in considering she serves in an institution with every form of bias one can possibly imagine, I think I'd argue that things are better. And by the way, if you look at CNN, there are some terrific reporters who are not. The traditional notion when I started doing TV, for example, was a guy could be like 77, as you said there.
And 77 and bald or gray-haired or overweight or out of shape.
Exactly. And the woman anchor or reporter had to be 35, great-looking, short dress, all that kind of thing.
That's right.
I actually, it has gotten a little better.
It has?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there have always been exceptions. I mean, Barbara Walters was on television late into her career.
Maybe it is just exceptions.
She's an exception. Judy Woodruff, who just left the NewsHour at CNN, I mean at PBS.
Well, she's still doing work, though. She's just not hosting the NewsHour.
Right, but she was an exception. I would argue that Christiane Amanpour from CNN, she's an exception. There are a couple of women whose careers
maybe
have been
right.
just phenomenal, but I think
it's
absolutely the exception. Basically, you're talking about some guy sitting next to a woman who looks like his daughter. Is that that's what you're talking about on television?
And he's probably hitting on his daughter.
He's probably hitting on his daughter too. So, I mean, I think you know the message is clear. Let me tell you, I'm doing whatever it takes, Jim, to hang on. Whatever it takes.
877-301-8970. I stupidly said, "Is there a double standard?" There obviously is a double standard. How bad is it? And by the way, as Marjorie said, this is we're using examples from the media. We're not. This is not limited to the media. This is. I agree with Marjorie. It's virtually every industry, every walk of life. There's the same sort of crap. So if you have some experience with this, we'd love to hear you tell us.
You know what? I think there are some exceptions for women. I think you can be a physician, I think, and get pretty old and not to worry about it. You might be able to be a marriage counselor or a family counselor or something like that. There are certain professions. But, I mean, I wrote a piece about this a long time ago in Boston Magazine. When you look at women in lawyers, women in business, women in politics, women in anything that you're out visual. I mean, you can't get
before old. We take the call, start with the calls at 877-301-8970. By the way, if anybody in the audience wants to weigh in, Hannah, where is Hannah? Hannah is right there. Hannah's right there. She's waving her hand. Wave back. You go over to her if you have something to say that is not ridiculous. We would like to have you on the. If it is ridiculous, talk to Hannah about it. What was the exception I was going to mention a minute ago? No, I forgot. 877-30. Oh, tell the story of one of my favorite columns of yours, speaking about aging. About you walking down the street past construction workers when you were in your 20s.
This was a long time ago.
It's a great column.
A long time ago when I turned 40. I said, you know, and a lot of women can relate to this. When you're 18 or 20 years old and you're walking down the street and you see a group of construction guys having lunch, you probably will walk a couple of blocks to avoid them. When you're 30 years old, you might just cross the street, you know, and because you're more mature and you're 30 years old. But when you're 40 or older, you walk right by them and hope that just one of them will pick his face out of his lunchbox and say something. You know, it's because it's that's how. So Don Lemon said a very bad thing. And
that was,
you know,
not
women,
misspeaking, though, by the way. That was not, because a lot of people are defending him, saying, well, when you do live television or live radio for hours a day, that was a pretty, it seemed to be a heartfelt.
Well, I think
point of view,
he's saying something that he shouldn't have said, but to say that many people view women in their prime it's not past 40 is tragically true.
Yeah. 877-301-8970. Let's start on the Cape with John. John, you're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Thank you. Hey. Okay, it was an artful on his part, but I feel like the national conversation about this has left Haley off the hook. Nikki Haley.
Oh, Nikki Haley. Okay. Well, how did it leave her off the hook?
Because she was being ageist in recommending that a mental test be done before. Who's going to decide what test it is? And whether you pass it or not.
John, you're not going to like this. For those who didn't read about this, she suggested in an attempt to say that, without saying it overtly, that both Trump and Biden were too old to serve, that there should be cognitive tests for anybody who wants to run for president who's over 75. John, do you know who agrees with her? Me.
You?
Yeah, I couldn't agree.
Jim, how do you objectively do that? Who decides what the test is?
You put together a panel of doctors that's bipartisan, and you do it. I mean, if you're not worried about older people being in great positions of power, I think you're not looking at the stats. I know this may, well, it isn't ageist. It's real. And they should also take driver's tests.
I think there's a big difference here. People's concern about Biden is not how he looks or whether he's got gray hair. Their concern
is cognitive.
Exactly. And I think it's a different thing for women. It's about how they look. And I think, frankly, I would say to John that Nikki Haley is a good-looking woman and she's going to do really well. But it's not totally about women because basically in 2023, you can't be a bad-looking man, a lot of them, and get a big office nationwide. Look at the men politicians. Most of them are good-looking, too. But the women have to be good-looking, and that was Hillary Clinton's problem. She may have been a good-looking woman when she was 30, but she was aging, and we couldn't stand seeing a woman who looked her age on television.
877-301-8970 is our number. Where would you like us to go back in Brighton? Do you want to give us a little clue here?
We're getting a lot of congratulations, Jim.
I know, but I don't feel comfortable reading those. They're very nice notes that people are sending us for 10 years.
Daniel in Somerville said, Tulsi Gabbard, a very good-looking woman.
By the way, three times you've mentioned how good-looking people are.
That's the issue. It's not just whether... because the thinking is, if you have gray hair, you're not as sexy as you are if you have blonde hair or brown hair.
Okay.
The issue for women, Jim, is sex appeal. Mm-hmm. That's what the issue is. And the idea that... And by the way... they have denied this all in Canada.
Of course.
But she decided during the pandemic when the hair salons shut down that she was going to do this. And believe me, Jim, I've thought more about this than you have.
Well, obviously, you pretty much have, haven't you?
I have.
Looking
That's
at
right.
me?
Root Rescue. You can buy it at CVS.
Root Rescue.
It costs about $10. And you can go there if you go to get your hair done at the salon, you're talking big bucks. You can't be going once a month to get your hair
colored. See, that's
colored.
The problem with moving to public radio. As great as the 10 years have been, if we were still on commercial radio, you could do spots for Root Rescue.
I could.
And make some not only serious money, but
I could.
Free product, as
that's,
they say.
That's
what
right.
What did Daniel from Somerville say?
Daniel from Somerville, is he on the...
No, you're the one who started.
Daniel from Somerville, who said, Tulsi Gabbard had a really cool white streak through her jet black hair. He thought it looked a little bit like Cruella in 101 Dalmatians. But she was from Hawaii, right?
She was.
Yeah.
Kathy in Rhode Island, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about double standards. Particularly off this LaFlemme situation in Canada. Hi there.
Hi. Well, you know, I just wanted to let you know, I had like sort of the opposite experience.
Mm-hmm.
And because when I was young, I wasn't taken seriously. And I work in academics. Do you hear an echo, or is that me?
No, whatever you hear, we're doing great with you, so keep talking.
Okay, all right, great.
Thanks.
So I'm in academics, and when I looked young and cute, people just didn't give me much credit and didn't take me seriously. I am pushing 70 now, and finally, people do take me seriously, and it took that long.
Well, let me tell you something. I had a similar experience. When I was young and cute, I wasn't taken seriously. And now that I have one foot in the grave, everybody is really taking me seriously.
Academics, Kathy, may be another area. There are certain fields where I think you can get older, but they're few and far between. Certainly television is not one of them, or politics is not one of them, if you're a woman. But in academics, you may have a point. Thank you very much for the
Thanks
call.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, by the way, can we hear from Lisa LaFlemme? Here she is herself, this former Canadian TV anchor, In a Twitter video last summer, after she was canned by CTV and after a decade as an anchor with the station. Here she is.
At 58, I still thought I'd have a lot more time to tell more of the stories that impact our daily lives. Instead, I leave CTV humbled by the people who put their faith in me to tell their story. While it is crushing to be leaving CTV National News in a manner that is not my choice, please know reporting to you has truly been the greatest honor of my life, and I thank you for always being there.
That's a pretty nice statement.
Very classy.
Pretty gracious statement. By the way, that caller said, how do you come up with a cognitive test for presidents, like it was suggested by Nikki Haley? Aiden came up with one. Five words: person, woman, man, camera, TV. Do you remember that with Donald Trump?
Yeah. We have some good emails. Jeff in Duxbury says, you only have to look at our local news channels and see their morning broadcasts to realize that the double standard is in full
effect. Well, by the way,
effect.
I don't watch local news that much. Mm-hmm. Most of the men are pretty young, too.
Steve from Tewksbury says, what's up with all the female news anchors and weather women seeming to wear nothing but these tight-fitting body-forming dresses in two pieces? What happened to blazers and blouses? Well, there was a woman at Channel 5 who wrote about this after she left Channel 5. I'm embarrassed. I can't think of her name at the moment. She wrote a piece in the Globe saying
I used to work
because
with her at NECN.
The pressure came from the news directors to wear those very, very sexy outfits. And we know Roger Ailes, the late Roger Ailes, who started Fox News, demanded that women wear short dresses on Fox News. No pants were allowed.
Okay, let's go to Mary Catherine in Arlington. Welcome, Mary Catherine. How are you?
Hi. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm the Mary Catherine that used to own upstairs.
One of the great places, Mary Catherine. It's great to talk to you again in Harvard Square.
Thank you, and I loved having you in as customers.
Well, you're very nice.
So we were on Holyoke Street back in upstairs at the Pudding way back in the 80s and early 90s. And we all got our hair done at Gino's, who owned a salon right next to us on Holyoke Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. And we used to laugh and say he kept us all blonde, or at least he kept us all in shape. And I sort of was, you know, approaching my 40s. And I certainly, given my genetics, would have turned, you know, gray or white. And I kind of bridged that. And I said, you know, is there a way for me to look natural? And I think in Cambridge, you know, the one place you maybe can't. And he said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And then I came back and he had talked to my partner, Deborah Hughes, who was, you know, a style maven, mm-hmm. had a walk waist and had those big Chanel sunglasses, would look me over every day to see if I, like, passed muster to be able to be on the floor, you know, I mean, in a kind way. Mm. But anyway, so I went over there. Absolutely not. And now I'm in my, you know, third career as a director of development for Cambridge Center for Adult Education. And guess what? I would never go gray. I also want to say just quickly, there's gray and there's gray. Like some people, as they age, have great coarse, thick hair and you know, just straight, and they look fantastic. And I have friends like that. I mean, look, and also there's also people famous enough, like Sarah Lightfoot, you know, who embrace their gray. But for the most part, those of us who are, you know, aging and stay jobs that they love, they kind of want to, you know, they don't want to necessarily be gray.
We got it, Mary Catherine. Great to hear from you again. We miss your place. Thank you so much. For the call, we got to take a break, Marjorie.
We do have to take a break. But we're talking about this news anchor in Canada, one of the highest-rated news anchors in Canada, who essentially, no matter what they say, lost her job because during the pandemic she let her hair go gray, and she was out. 877-301-8970 is the number to call or text us. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com, GBH News, and facebook.com/GBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live at the BPL, streaming at youtube.com/GBHNews and on facebook.com/GBHNews. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the stigmas around having gray hair, or just getting older if you're a woman in this society. It was sparked by the story of that Canadian anchor, Lisa LaFlemme, plus Don Lemon's comments about Nikki Haley. Are you in the camp of someone like Representative Clark, Catherine Clark, embracing your gray hair and what it means to age naturally, or have you given in to the fact that there is a double standard and you have to deal with it? You can give us a call or a text at 877-301-897. You know what story I totally forgot until,
what?
I don't know what it was with the call. Many, many years ago, I was at NECN, and my contract was up. And remember Jody Applegate, who sat in for us a couple times?
Yep,
she was brilliant.
Yep.
She was offered the morning anchor job at Channel 25.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted me as her co-host. I snuck over there and tried out. I was absolutely abysmal. And the woman who was the general manager called me in afterwards. She says, you were pretty bad, and we're going to give you the job anyway because Jody's the star and she wants you. Remember what the next thing she said to me was?
You had to dye your hair.
I had to dye my hair black. I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
And in a rare act of principle, what was I thinking? It's a lot of money, too. I chose not to do it.
And I don't know.
There you go.
I don't know. But you're someone that was prematurely gray. You were
going gray
when you were younger. Heather Unruh is the journalist. Unruh, excuse me. She's the journalist who wrote the piece in the Globe about the pressure to dress provocatively in the news stations. Thank you for the texter who sent that.
And it's not her, texter, by the way. It wasn't Heather Unruh. It was Heather Kahn. It was. It was Heather Kahn. It wasn't?
No.
Okay.
Heather Kahn has dark hair. Heather Unruh is blonde.
Yeah, okay. All right.
And somebody mentioned Maria Stefanos and Ed Harding. They're at Channel 5, and they're not young. It's true. But Ed Harding is an older guy. Maria Stefanos...
She's not old.
...is not old, and she looks fantastic. I mean, I think that's part of the deal. If you can pull it off, some people can pull it off. If people are old enough, they remember Natalie Jacobs, and she looked pretty good and quite into her old age. But
she did indeed.
She's another exception to the rule. Maria Stefanos is really talented, and she's
not that old.
No.
She's not 30, but she's
no.
not that old.
Well, what is she, 45, 50,
know.
Something like that?
By the way, someone texted, we should have mentioned this too, it's because we didn't do our research. George Santos developed an anti-aging serum that works miracles. So during the next pledge drive here, we're going to be selling $10 a month or $120 all at once.
Yeah, okay.
877-301-8970. You know what Jamie just reminded me of?
What?
You sent me a note.
What?
LaToya Edwards, who we saw a couple of weeks ago when she hosted the Embrace dedication. Remember when
great.
He did her hair?
She looked great.
And she wrote a piece about it, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of trepidation that it wasn't going to be acceptable to a lot of people. Well, she was strong, and it's a different situation, but a variation on a theme, and I would argue she's more popular than ever. Isn't that some indication there's a little bit of progress?
Well, again, she looks terrific.
Yeah, but she doesn't fit the traditional mold, I'm saying.
I guess what I'm saying, Jim, is if you are a really good-looking woman and you look good at 40 or 50, as I would say Nikki Haley does, you're probably going to be okay. But if you are a woman who begins to show her age, like Hillary Clinton, you're not going to be okay. LaToya Edwards looks fantastic.
You think that's why Hillary Clinton is not president of the United States?
I think that had part to do with it.
Or
remember the Mike Barnicle line?
Don't use it. Gigi in Boston, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Gigi, welcome.
Hi, Marjorie and Jim, can you hear me?
If you said, can you hear me, we can.
Okay. First time, long time.
Thank you.
I was saying that Nikki Haley is not in her prime. And I'll tell you the reason why. She's only 51. You don't hit your prime till you hit 55.
Oh, is that it?
And so
what happens at 55? Why 55?
You know, she's approaching it well because then you have wisdom and you have experience and you obviously have credentials. And by then, you know, you're really in your prime. She's approaching her prime.
Okay.
That's a great standard. Thank you.
Not there yet.
We'll pass it along to Don Lemon. Gigi, thank you for your call.
Yeah, we've seen quite a few presidents who are much younger than 55.
Presidents?
Yes.
Well, not how many. How many have we seen?
Well, Kennedy.
Bill Clinton. Kennedy.
Obama.
Obama, yeah. Joe Biden.
How old was George Bush?
George Bush the Younger.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how old
he
was.
Yeah, I think we've had quite
50s,
a few.
Yeah.
I don't know the age of a lot of them, but a lot of them were a lot younger than 55.
But what's the criterion there? The vast majority of men, because there have only been men who've been elected president, what quality do they have that differs from the person they beat much more often than not?
Taller.
That's exactly right. Taller candidate almost always wins. Not always, but almost always wins.
Why aren't you president, Jim?
Exactly, because I have gray hair. Exactly. 877-301-8970.
Suzanne and Newton, thank you for calling.
Hey.
Hello.
Hello.
I love that. I really love this topic. It's making me laugh because my friends and I always say ageism is alive and well, and it's and especially when it comes to employment and all of this. But it also starts in the home because I'm a teacher and I occasionally work with first graders. And a couple years ago and this year, I had two different students say the darndest thing. And one little girl says to me, "Why do you have gray hair?" And I said, "Because I don't dye it." And she said, Oh yeah, my grandmother does that." Like it was such an anomaly. And then, of course, then I'm like, well, you know, I guess I'm like your grandmother. Like kind of feeling old at that moment. And then this year, a little girl said, "Why do you have gray hair?" It's about 80% gray. And I said, same thing, because I don't dye it. And then, like, her friend said, "Well, why do you have so many wrinkles?" And I said, "Well, because I'm old." You know, but it feels really, really uncomfortable when kids are saying those things, you know?
Well, you know, Suzanne, when you think about it, you don't see that many older women on TV.
Well, it's not just about TV.
It's part
She's
of it.
She's not talking about being on TV.
Well, kids watch TV, no. Don't they?
I mean, it's the standard, you mean?
Yeah, I think
Thank
you see
Suzanne.
A lot more older men on TV than you see older women on TV.
Yeah, well, that's true. That's, of course, true.
I mean, there are older women on TV that... I mean, you can see a lot of older women in the movies, but I think that's not exactly what they look like, or they got very expensive help to look the way
well,
they look.
Well, but on a serious
you know,
note,
incredible.
Other than 80 for Brady, the new film,
yep.
With three incredibly talented
Jane
women.
Jane Fonda.
Right.
I remember interviewing her
and
a few
Lily
years
Tomlin.
Ago.
Who's the third?
I don't know, but I remember interviewing Jane Fonda. But first of all, I was surprised. Jane Fonda's a lot shorter than I am. I was surprised. I thought she was a tall woman. But anyway, she's 80-something.
85.
Obviously, she's got a lot of money to get, you know, a lot of help. But she looked unbelievably great. She didn't look bad. She just looked terrific, I thought. And she's in her 80s. And you know something? I don't think Nancy Pelosi could have lasted as long as she did in the House if she had gone gray and not done anti-aging things.
I do. I really
don't.
I hope you're wrong. George W. was 54 when he was
thank
elected.
Thank you.
877-301-8970. Paul in Wellesley, hey.
Oh, Sally Field
hey,
is in the 80 for Brady.
Oh, she's the 30.
Yeah, Sally Field.
Oh,
thank
I started
you.
To say. Wait a second. Well, is how many great women actors say they can't get starring parts anymore when they cross a certain threshold?
Well, it's better now. It used to be you couldn't get them when you were past 30. Now you see women in their 40s and 50s, but fewer. But you do see women in their 40s, certainly, that still get, you know, roles as the
so what's the solution
love interest.
This? Well, after Paul, tell me what the solution is.
Jim,
Paul
I have no idea, but when
Perfect.
We find it, I'm ready to embrace it.
Didn't our new boss the other day when we interviewed her, Susan Goldberg, say we shouldn't just identify problems, we should identify
solutions.
Actions to fix
know.
Them?
I'm looking for one.
Okay, fine. Paul and Wellesley, finally, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
I want to say, to start with, I just wanted to say, I happen to think women with gray and sometimes salt and pepper hair can be very sexy looking. And
I agree.
They
totally.
Can,
maybe because of my age. But the thought what prompted me to call is I do discrimination law cases.
Oh.
And your boss, you just mentioned your boss wants to talk about things that can be done about these problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's clearly unfair that people whose hair turns gray get fired. There's obviously a connection with age, so it may be an ageism thing, but there's also another connection that intrigues me because I like to do a little bit novel cases.
And so what is it?
What it is sex is a protected class. You know that.
Yeah.
Women can't be fired because they're women. And discrimination is defined as differential treatment. So if men who turn gray are not fired and women who turn gray are fired, I'm thinking that might be a sex discrimination case.
Yeah.
And I just thought I'd mention that because that could be something that could be done. This is clearly an extremely unfair practice. It's pretty prevalent. But
well, you know, let me tell you, Paul, I'm not familiar with the law. I'm sure I'm not nearly as familiar as you are. I'm assuming that gender discrimination has been a centerpiece of a lot of these, a lot of this litigation when a woman in the situation you described has been fired. No?
Yes.
Okay, so we agree. But, Paul, thank you. We appreciate your call. Thank you.
Listen to this. I dyed my hair purple to celebrate my 65th birthday. Young people are much friendlier to me now that my hair is purple, and my jokes seem much funnier, never going back.
That's really pretty sad. We have time for one more quick one. It's Beth in Marshfield. Hey, Beth, welcome.
Hi. I'm a kindergarten teacher, and I'm 63. I don't dye my hair. And, oops, a little feedback.
It's okay.
And 5 years ago, I think people started asking me when I was going to retire. And I'm not easily insulted, but I do find that question insulting. I think it has to do with not dyeing my hair.
Yeah.
It might.
Yeah,
Don't retire, Beth, if you're happy. Thanks for the call.
I think there's a definite prejudice. Some places you can get away with it. Some professions you can get away with it. I think it's very difficult. Maria Stefanos is in her 50s, and she does look fantastic.
By the way, I should also say, in the spirit, it's showing that things may be getting better. You do have a degree, reading the text. A lot of people ask me the same question. Why don't you retire? So there's... So apparently,
I think it's for different reasons, Jim.
I think it may be.
Don't you think?
Okay.
Well, that's enough of that. We are moving on. We have not solved anything. We haven't found a solution. But
if
anybody has one, I'd be very happy to hear it. We're going to be talking just up next. It's been
Jim. Wait a second. You were just a couple of years younger than Biden. Do you want to have that test requirement as condition for hosting BPR? TV, animal, what are the five things? Whatever Donald Trump said there. I can't even remember the five.
Yeah, you know, remember when we talked about getting licenses, people should be tested again for driving licenses?
Yes, I do.
Because you're tested once at 16, and you're never road tested again.
You drive
at
100.
And these BU people.
Geriatric Center.
I forget the percentage, but it was huge, of people 85 that have some kind
of dementia.
Or signs
of dementia, yeah.
So and Biden is going to be 86 if he serves
this.
And so I think that's what people are concerned about with Joe Biden, is an 86-year-old president. I mean, I think it makes people nervous, and I think they got a point. Anyway, after quick break, it's been a year since the Boston Globe launched or relaunched The Emancipator, one of the country's first abolitionist newspapers. Amber Payne is editor-in-chief. We talked to her before when this whole thing was beginning, and we're going to talk to her again in just a moment. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library. Stream at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews. We're getting a lot of texts saying, what's with the cake? It is our 10th anniversary
show. 10th anniversary.
2 o'clock we'll
That's
be serving
right.
cake. Let's try to get to the bottom of this. How many people in the audience are solely here because of the free cake? Raise your hand. That's everybody. Okay, great. At least you're honest. We're joined by Amber Payne. Amber's editor-in-chief of The Emancipator from the Boston Globe, co-founded by Ibram X. Kendi of BU and Bina Venkatraman, the former editorial page editor of the Globe, in the spirit of one of the first abolitionist papers in the U.S., founded more than 200 years ago with the same name. It's been about 1 year since The Emancipator relaunched, and Amber joined us a year ago, and she's back now to give us an update. Amber, it's great to see you.
Thanks for being here. Thank you very much.
Great to see you guys
for
again.
Coming in. So tell people who don't know, what is The Emancipator?
Sure.
Elaborate on what Jim said.
Yeah, you know, The Emancipator was founded as a collaboration between the Boston Globe and Boston University. The idea came about in the summer of 2020, and the idea was to reimagine the first abolitionist newspaper. for a new day. So when you think about those abolitionist papers, what was their purpose? They were trying to end slavery, and that was radical at the time.
Yeah.
A lot of the ideas they were putting out, you know, there was no room for moderacy or compromise. So, you know, in the same spirit we are looking at today, we're looking at 2020, 2023, where we're still facing these issues of not chattel slavery, but of racism, of structural racism. So the purpose of the Emancipator is to reframe this conversation on race and equity with a focus on solutions, with a focus on deconstructing systems and defining what is structural racism, how does it actually impact me in my everyday life. A lot of people can't quite make that connection. So we're focused on commentary, perspective, first-person essay, video commentary, and as well as in-person community events.
You know, I believe the first time I interviewed Ibram Kendi after the Emancipator launched, I said, and he talked about attacking racism through the Emancipator, trying to end it. I said, essentially, come on. I mean, do you really believe we can end racism in this country? Do you know what his answer was? Because I bet he said it internally. If you asked the same question 200 years ago, to the people behind the original Emancipator, they'd say we're never going to end slavery, and they did.
Right.
So, I mean, is that sort of the spirit that guides this? Because it does seem to be so deeply baked into virtually everything around us.
Yeah, well, you know, we need to reimagine what it looks like to have a world without racism. And a lot of that is looking at structural issues, institutions, financial, health system, education systems. So why can't we picture that? Why can't we picture what that you know, ideal system is? And with journalism and scholarship, really excavate, you know, the possibilities. We're trying to reimagine a new future for.
One of the things that you mentioned, and I know that you've worked on, is health equity. And we have the former head of the Boston NAACP, who's now on the national board of the NAACP with us every single week, and he's part of this health equity compact of 55 leaders of color in the healthcare community that have filed a report and a bill on Beacon Hill. Is the perverse benefit of the inequities in healthcare making the front page during COVID in some ways helpful to the cause, do you think?
Well, I think, yeah, COVID... In 2020, when the Emancipator was really conceived, we were all in the thick of COVID, and those racial disparities were really coming to the fore. But we're still seeing them. And I think, you know, I don't want to call it a wake-up call because I don't know if everyone's awake, but maybe an alarm bell where some got to understand the differences in healthcare opportunities and health outcomes. So we have a solution, you know, we have a health equity series that we've done looking at, you know, other aspects of health inequality that might be kind of unexpected.
Like, well, what, for example? Tell us, like what?
Yeah.
The thing, you did a piece about women, including the most famous women like Serena Williams and Beyonce. I didn't realize that women like that are superstars and have millions of dollars would face racism in healthcare when having children. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we did a story it focused on breastfeeding and some work that women, I think it's Brigham and Women's, is doing around helping women of color, black women, but there's also a high Latina population that needs to be served with helping them access, you know, information about breastfeeding, not giving up on them. There's just disparities in how, you know, the research found there are disparities in how these women were treated, you know, after giving birth and being encouraged to nurse their babies or not being, as strongly encouraged to. And it looks at, you know, all aspects of the system because you're looking at, you know, what is the racial makeup of even just the nursing care, the doula system, very few women of color doulas.
Or very few black physicians.
Black physicians, yeah exactly. So just looking at, you know, how can programs, you know, they have a particular, very, proactive system to help black women on their breastfeeding journey.
Yeah.
You know, I asked you or your co-editor who was here when this thing began, aren't you just going to be preaching to the choir? And I think what you said was, we have two audiences. The choir, you didn't use that word.
Yeah.
People with open minds, but we're not going to waste time on people who have closed minds because they're locked shut kind of thing. Do you have any evidence that people who are not bought in but had open minds have read the Emancipator on a regular basis and are getting religion, or is it just still a hope? I'm serious.
you know, we get feedback. We get comments on social media. We get people replying to our newsletter. We have people who, actually in particular on the newsletter, who, you know, they're asking questions. Mm-hmm. They're giving us, relaying an incident and asking us, you know, our take on that. And we're not an advice column, maybe not yet, uh-huh. But that just kind of raises the question that I think people still have these questions and they don't know how to ask them, they don't know where to find the information, and they don't know how it really impacts their daily lives and what they can do about it. You know, we haven't done this story yet, but we talked to the inner city weightlifting organization. I don't know if you all know them. They're, you know, Boston-based, and, mm-hmm. and the work that they do with the
previously incarcerated
yeah. population. And they've told me an anecdote of other folks who access the gym who have actually gone back to their jobs and said, mm-hmm. you know, we need to think about making exceptions for people who are part of the formerly incarcerated when it comes to them applying for a job and getting a job. That's just a huge barrier. So that was really, you know, inspiring. You know, a real person thinking, you know, that doesn't impact me. I haven't been incarcerated. I don't have a family member. But what can you do actually if you have if you have access to power or access, you know, to change the system?
By the way, Sean Ellis, who we've talked to a number of times, you'll know, is running the Exoneree Network, which is a variation of the thing. Armand Coleman doing a similar kind of thing. So there seems to be a lot of attention on that.
Those men were in jail for
decades.
For a long
time. Talking to Amber Payne from The Emancipator.
You know, you talked about when you were here before that this is about people of color in general, not just African Americans, Black people, Latinas. You just mentioned. But this is a little clip from from a Mexican American neighborhood. This is a video highlighting Little Village in Chicago. First, you're going to hear urban historian Sherman Dilla Thomas in conversation with a local business owner, Mike Marino.
You kind of get a pure representation of the person's homeland because of that segregation, right? And so when you come to Little Village, it feels a lot like you could be in Mexico City or Guadalajara in certain spaces. Is it important to maintain that aesthetic for the health and vitality of the community?
It is important. Not that we don't allow people to come in, but one day I asked my dad out of the blue, I said, Dad, why don't you get out of the neighborhood and move someplace else? He said, for what? He said, everybody here speaks Spanish. And he says, I'm like in Mexico as it is. This was home to him.
So you're not just doing Boston, and you're not just doing African Americans. You've got a wide lens.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the Emancipator is created through the lens of Black liberation and opportunity and that civil rights struggle, but that struggle is reflected across many communities. And that particular clip you're playing is this health equity tour that we did in Chicago in Little Village. And we think of health as, you know, okay, a clinic and a clinical experience, but these folks from Little Village were talking to us about the neighborhood, about kind of keeping it ungentrified, about keeping the abuelas safe. There was a huge heat wave, I think, in the 90s, and in that community, they lost the least amount of elderly folks because of that kind of community family system of the grandparents living in the homes. And so it's just kind of finding unique ways to think about health and equity and keeping communities healthy.
I was just going to say, the other thing I find very interesting that you guys are doing is the talk.
Oh.
Tell us about that. Mm.
Yeah. I'll have some coffee first. Why don't
the talk, you know, actually, and President Biden mentioned the talk at the State of the Union, right? So the talk, kind of typically known as the conversation that Black and brown parents have with their kids about how to keep them safe in this world, what to do when you get pulled over and get stopped by police. But we started thinking about it, especially around back to school, about the talk that's kind of happening right now in many other communities and that may have historically also been given. We talked to a Black queer family with a queer child. That's a very nuanced conversation they're having for back to school. But also Indian American families. Disability justice is also a focus for us. So the Rebecca Coakley, who's part of the Ford Foundation's disability, head of their disability project, she talked to us about what she tells her kids who have dwarfism. And how to keep them safe in moving in the world. So it was very intersectional, including a white family. So we spoke to a white mother named Joanna, and she did a video essay for us on what she tells her white sons, a letter to my white sons, talking to them about white nationalisms and the danger of what they're seeing online.
Now, Amber, speaking of white nationalism, we're talking to Amber Payne, who's the editor of The Emancipator. I have a negative attitude about almost everything these days, so I'm hoping you're going to disabuse me of this. You know, the great line that the opponent of Ron DeSantis used in their debate in his first election as governor was, he was asked if DeSantis was a racist, and he said, "I don't know if he's a racist, but racists think he is." I think most people could say the same thing about the guy who's leading in the polls for the presidency, Donald Trump. He was leading Biden by 5 points yesterday in a poll. When 70-plus million people in the country are willing to endorse, embrace, love a credibly accused sexual predator, a guy who tried to overturn an election in the Constitution, and I would argue a pretty clear racist. Does that not cause hope to ebb out of your body? I mean, how do you overcome that? This is not like a fringe character. He is a fringe character, but he's a fringe character endorsed by tens of millions.
Well, you know, I have a very close family member who also voted for that person.
How do you deal with that?
That's hard. And I've had that, you know, I started to have some conversations with him about that.
The talk.
It's a different talk. Yeah, we had the talk. Yeah. So I could try to understand where they were coming from. And some of it with this particular family member was kind of about that piece of the pie. People think that, you know, there's this pie and if they get a slice, then I'm getting less.
Taking it from me.
You're taking it from me. And, you know, people moving into our neighborhoods, there's a lot of that. To me, that felt like kind of a journalistic challenge. I mean, I was essentially interviewing my family member about this to not judge them, but to try to, you know, okay, what is the blocker for you and what is the root of this? And that, to me, is then the journalistic challenge. Like, what kind of stories do we need to do that, not to target that audience, but that we are accessible to them? Because if they're thinking it, it's something that others, so many others are thinking
so
about.
So what's on the front or sort of mid burner for the next few months of the Emancipator?
Yeah. Well, I'm excited that we're working with some students from Northeastern and from Boston University. And the BU students, I met with them this morning, they've got, it's a program that intersects data and computer science and journalism. And so that's, you know, a resource and an opportunity for the Emancipator to also work with, you know, these young journalists who, before they get into these legacy newsrooms that, you know, we came up in with where things are still changing, you know, trying to really impact them and show them, you know, this kind of form of anti-racist journalism, of asset framing communities and of diving deep. So we're working on something with BU that's around environmental justice and redlining. And we're also working with a team in an aspect that's, they don't want me to give too much away, but the darkest corner of the criminal legal system, the origin of criminal cases and what happens to people who they essentially have no opportunity from the get-go.
So is restorative justice, which you talk about a lot, is that part of the mix?
Restorative justice, yeah. The Northeastern students, they're doing a very deep dive on restorative justice. These justice circles, they got to witness where you have victims and you have offenders and you have also attorneys and judges and other people within that whole system just in this collective circle talking and trying to heal, which seems wild.
Yeah,
it does seem
wild, but from everything I've heard, it can be so effective and really kind of healing for everybody involved. And you were involved anyway, in this whole thing about banning all these books.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's continuing. I mean, especially down in Florida where we have Ron DeSantis on a tear.
Starting with the banned books and now attacking, you know, AP curriculum.
Yes.
You know, I was reading a story, I think it was the Tampa Bay Times, about this other form of testing called CLT, the Classic Learning Test. Something that could be used by, you know, that's used by homeschoolers and other communities. And it's not something that DeSantis has signed off on, but it's just in the mix of conversation.
That's because he wants to fire the College Board, isn't it? That's to replace the College Board, is it not? I think.
I don't know if that's, not yet, but okay. Yeah, I think it's getting there. But what it draws me to the counter to that is what are black and brown parents doing now, you know, to make sure their kids are getting that kind of education. You know, there was an NBC story about homeschooling that really was focused on black communities homeschooling. You know, Nicole Hannah-Jones of the 1619 Project opened a freedom school in her hometown of Iowa that has kind of, you know, after-school curriculum for students. So
that's,
you know,
wonderful.
It's always going to be measured. And it goes back to, you know, Freedom Summer, Mississippi Freedom Summer, and the freedom schools after, you know, desegregation of Brown versus Board. We weren't seeing equal schools. And it came upon these communities to figure out something for themselves. So I'm discouraged by Ron DeSantis and what he is doing, but I am hopeful that, you know, these communities, you know, like leaning into communities to help lead us to solutions.
I hope you're right. So before you tell us how people can subscribe and get whatever it is you are doing, can you objectively grade your first year in existence? I mean, no, I'm serious. I mean, it's a really important thing, but is it working, do you think?
I think that's the feedback we're getting, that it is working. And I think it's part, and I think it's because there are kind of three components. We have the editorial, you know, if you want to read a piece and get an explainer or read a perspective.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But it's, you there. Also have social media, where sometimes we don't cover something on the site. We cover it on social. We go directly there. Let's go to where you've got this thing in your hand all day. Mm-hmm. You're scrolling. Let's, you know, Instagram. You guys on TikTok?
No, I read it. I'm not on
okay.
it.
You said you read it.
Well, I mean, I look at it.
Watch
I look
it.
At it. I click on it. Yeah. Yeah.
So TikTok, you know, finding communities there. And then community events. You know, last year we did have a Juneteenth party in Roxbury that was curated by and for the community and artists of the community. We had a banned books week conversation. Dr. Kendi spoke to Congresswoman Cori Bush in D.C. So we want to do more of that. I think that's what's coming up for us, more authentic community events, being a tool, being a resource.
How do people find you?
Oh, follow us. You can go to theemancipator.org. You can also follow us on all the socials, the_emancipator.
Congratulations on the first year. It's really great.
Yeah.
Everybody involved.
And as I always say, I'm always humiliated and embarrassed by everything I don't know about what's going on in the history of the United States of America. So thank you for filling in a lot of those gaps for us.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Speaking with Amber Payne. She's editor-in-chief of The Emancipator. Emancipator.org is how you get it. Okay, up next, it's been a year since Russia sent its first troops into Ukraine. We'll speak with GBH news analyst and the Ground Truth Project's Charlie Sennett about that. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. We are live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. Quick break. We'll be right back.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. The Ground Truth Project's Charlie Sennett joins us on 1 year of war in Ukraine. Then it's GBH's Callie Crossley joining us to discuss de facto life sentences for two sexual predators, Harvey Weinstein and R. Kelly.
I'm Marjorie Egan. We'll also talk with the producers of PBS' new kids show, Work It Out Wombats. And it's Live Music Friday. The Hamilton Garrett Center for Music and Arts is a nonprofit in Greater Roxbury, supporting arts among the city's black youth. Executive Director Jeremy Groover Flores joins us to discuss this weekend's fundraiser, Make Them Hear You, along with MC and BPR regular Emma G. Price III. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Back to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. I am Marjorie Egan. We are live with Jim Browdy here at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News as well. What are you laughing at?
Every single person I know has texted me in the last 5 minutes to say something like, you read TikTok? It was the first verb that came to mind. I'm going to block
okay,
all
you look
of you.
At it.
Stop
you look at it.
By the way, it's our 10th anniversary here on GBH Radio. We're going to serve cake at 2 o'clock. So it's been 1 year, speaking of horrible anniversaries, since Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine. In that time, there have been over 20,000 civilian casualties, at least 8.5 million Ukrainian refugees scattered across the world. Earlier this week, President Biden visited Kyiv, as you know, in a show of support for the people there before heading to Poland to reassure our NATO allies. We're joined now at the BPL by GBH News analyst Charlie Sennett. He's the founder and editor of Ground Truth Project. He has been to Ukraine since the invasion started. And I just realized, on a happier note before we get to Ukraine, were you not on our first show 10 years ago?
If it wasn't the first, it was the first week.
Well, that's pretty good.
So
just
happy to be
you
along
think
for the ride.
Last, right?
Yeah.
You're sure it wouldn't last, right?
Excuse me. On a happier note, Charlie comes bearing gifts.
I do. What
do
I've got gifts for you
he
guys.
He has a present.
Happy anniversary.
And he's giving it to me.
What
thank you
for you
much,
guys.
Charlie.
He just gave it to Marjorie.
Smart enough to give it to Marjorie.
What is
that's
it?
That's right.
What is it?
Well, I'm looking right now. There's a T-shirt.
Can I tell
in
you,
here.
If it's not food, I'm not that interested.
Okay, it's a T-shirt. This is from
that's pretty good,
the
actually.
Ground Truth Project. This is because
hold it up to the camera.
This is because Jim and Charlie got in a little mano a mano
thing
a while ago about
really
how often I promote the brand.
Greater Boston versus Ground Truth Project. Greater Boston versus Ground Truth Project. That is great, and we have something else in here. Hold on, I'll open this up too.
By the way, I won that to do for whatever it's
right.
worth. But
with no smugness, we present you.
Oh, how nice.
Oh, very nice.
Very nice. That is really nice.
It's not quite as funny as the legendary smug mug. But thank you
we're
very,
very
much.
Genuine.
Thank you. It's
I
very
love
sweet
this.
Of you.
Report the world. Thank you very much, Charlie. Thank
right.
you very much.
You are welcome. Happy anniversary.
Happy thank anniversary. You. So let's get back to the horrible, sad anniversary that you're here about the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. So just give us an overall. Where are we a year in?
Yeah, stalemate. I think that right now this war feels locked. It feels like it's going nowhere. And that's how it feels now. But if you go back a year ago, when the entire world, including President Biden, thought that this would happen very fast and that we would see Putin and his forces sweep through Kyiv, that was what was the accepted wisdom back then. Zelensky was insulted. Zelensky has proven that he is an extraordinary world leader.
Yeah.
I think we'll be talking about this guy for a very long time. I think he will be in the history books 100 years from now for standing up to Putin, standing up to Russia, and really protecting Ukraine as a country. And it is a miracle that it's still standing. And I think Biden's trip recently was just all about that. It was, hey, Putin, I'm here. You're not.
You know, we're going to play a little sound. I'm so glad you brought up Zelensky right away because I am in awe of him. Those early articles not only talked about him being over his head, but there was guessing on the over-under in terms of how many days it was going to be
right.
before he left the country with his family and that sort of thing, and obviously he did nothing of the sort. Here he is before Congress, just a couple of days before Christmas.
You can strengthen sanctions to make Russia feel how ruinous its aggression truly is. It is in your power. Really, to help us bring to justice everyone who started this unprovoked and criminal war. Let's do it. Let terrorists let the terrorist state be held responsible for its terror and aggression and compensate all losses done by this war. Let the world see that the United States are here.
You know, Charlie, over decades, you've covered leaders of all sorts all over the world, literally. Is there a common thread through the Zelenskys of the world that separates them from the weak leaders? You know what I mean?
I don't know of any leader this side of Nelson Mandela who has
really
the resilience of Zelensky. In the conflicts I've covered, seeing the way he has stood tall, seeing the way he has challenged even the United States. You know, there was this rumor that Biden was trying to tell him, look, we'll evacuate you when Kyiv falls. And he very famously said, hey, we need a hand, not a ride.
I remember. That was a great
and
line.
And that might be hypocritical, but it captures who he is.
It.
And it is, it's an extraordinary moment in history to see someone on the level of Churchill, who is confronting one of the most clear moral conflicts of our time. It really is between authoritarianism and democracy. And we are seeing a very stark conflict, and he embodies the integrity that's going to be what drives this thing through, which keeps the country together. So it's in a stalemate. but we can't forget the year of progress that's been made.
You know, Axios this morning gave us a by-the-numbers look at Ukraine and Russia and said Russia's launched 5,000 missile strikes, 3,500 airstrikes, 1,000 drone strikes. They point out that the amount of Ukrainian land controlled by Russian forces is down from 27% in March to 18%, but it's up a little bit from what was held by Russia, 7%, and Russian-aligned separatists when the war started. And then it gets to the casualties. 8,600 civilians killed, 13,000 injured. There's different estimates of how many Russian troops have been killed. I guess British estimates, 40,000 to 60,000, but other people think it's much higher than that.
Some people, as high as 100,000.
Yes, yes. And, of course, a lot of Ukrainians have been killed or wounded, 100,000 troops killed. So this has taken a huge toll.
Yeah, the human toll is just extraordinary. And on top of those deaths and those casualties are the displaced. Millions of people who are refugees or who are internally displaced in Ukraine and who have survived this winter. It's extraordinary. You know, when I was there in December and you could feel the cold just pounding down, seeing the resiliency of the people is one of the most inspiring things I've seen in my 40 years as a journalist.
Well, you did a great story that talked about the little girl with a pink sled going down in the snow, which you also talked about.
Well, she found a slab of rubble.
Yes.
That she used as the incline for sledding, which is a pretty good metaphor.
But you also talked about the journalists that had been covering this, because you actually visited their offices. Tell us about them.
Yeah, thanks. I wanted to say the journalism in this conflict has been extraordinary. The New York Times coverage has been amazing, and I had time with some of our colleagues in the field there, seeing how they're working. They are doing amazing work. I don't know if you saw today the photographs that they sort of told the year of the war through the most iconic photographs they've taken. Lindsay Addario, who we once had on your show, who's on our board of advisors. Tyler Hicks, who's an old friend, has done extraordinary work. The Guardian today has an amazing, very detailed account, almost like a forensic study, like a criminal assessment of Mariupol and the crimes that were committed there by the Russian troops. Human Rights Watch, which is not a news organization but is doing extraordinary reporting and documentation, has a piece that's really worth reading on the train station attack last April that killed dozens and that used cluster munitions. So Russia violated every international treaty there is, but the heroes of the war, the journalists who I admire the most are the Ukrainian journalists who we spent time with. One of them is Sevgil Museba, who's the editor-in-chief, very young, but editor-in-chief of Ukrainskaya Pravda, which is sort of the leading news organization that serves Ukraine. They've been around for 20 years, and their struggle, their fight for democracy, really began a full 20 years ago. They're responsible for a columnist who did the call to Maidan Square, so started the Maidan movement. They are fighting so hard and doing so well. And one of my favorite moments in Ground Truth was bringing a generator to their newsroom. That was one of my favorite moments of all the time we've had in supporting journalists in the field through Ground Truth. And I feel like the other one that's really worthy of note is the Kyiv Independent. They are doing extraordinary work. So I just feel such, I don't know, just am in awe of the excellent journalism that the Ukrainian journalists have done.
And as you point out, in years previously and up to now, people have been targeted for their reporting and murdered.
Their own newsroom has lost many people, including their publisher, who was killed 6 months after they launched in a brutal attack. They were exposing corruption and some of the Putin-allied autocrats and plutocrats took the publisher out, hoping to crush this independent news organization, and instead it inspired them. His photograph is everywhere in the newsroom, and you really feel this sense of commitment to the story they want to tell. They've had several journalists killed. They've had one killed in action. We've seen, I think it's 15 journalists have been killed in the war in Ukraine, and it is a number that's rising and getting, I don't know, it's the peril the journalists are facing, the proximity to the front lines are extraordinary, and I'm sad to say I think we'll see more deaths as the war escalates and we come into the spring offensive and counteroffensive.
You know, Charlie, Senator, I have to say I was truly inspired by Joe Biden's secret 10-hour train ride into Kyiv and then 10 hours back, And then him continuing to rally Eastern European countries in NATO, promising under, what is it, Article 5, it's called, that an attack on any one of us is an attack on all of us, and that's a sacred thing, he said. But then in the middle of that, you see Putin summoning the high-ranking Chinese emissary mm-hmm. in an incredibly warm meeting. And then you read, while Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State, is warning China not to get involved, China seems to be cozying up to Russia, maybe on the weaponry front. It's not the whole world. There's a great divide. Right. South Africa, China, yep. India. That split is really concerning. China in particular, yeah. Is it not?
It is, and this war is a seismic event. It's a 100-year event that has changed all of the geopolitical landscape in the world. It really has. It feels as fateful as World War I in the sense of what has changed, what has happened. So what we have, you had the UN vote yesterday. 141 of 193 nations voted to condemn Russia's unprovoked invasion.
Which is meaningless, right? I mean, it is.
Especially since there were 32 abstentions, most notably India and China, to your point. The seven that opposed it are kind of the rogue states, Syria, North Korea, et cetera. But those 32 abstentions really matter. And what I think is equally important is only 33 countries have imposed sanctions. So two-thirds of the world live in countries that are not imposing sanctions on Russia for this unprovoked invasion. So I think we have a false sense of unity here in the United States. The world is not 100% with us in the fight against Russia, against Putin.
Well, the people in the United States are not 100% with us in what the United States is doing. Right? We're divided, too.
The story that I read by Liz Sly in the Washington Post points out that a lot of the global South is mad at the United States for our lack of support for them, particularly in climate change and other areas. So you almost see it as kind of, we're Americans, you don't like to think this, but payback.
Yeah, I think we tend to forget our history, how we've carried ourselves in the world. So South Africa is case in point. Yes, post-apartheid South Africa has received tremendous support from the United States. I think all of us are proud of that support. But we can't forget that for decades, we accepted an apartheid state. We did very little. And while we were doing that, Russia was working on behalf of the ANC in South Africa, and that has not been forgotten in places like Soweto. And I think that we have to understand that we are constantly reconciling with how we carry ourselves in the world all the time. South Africa is this incredible litmus test right now to say, why is the world not so eager to jump on the side of the United States against Russia? Because there's some levels of hypocrisy that are impossible to avoid. What that argument misses...
Meaning that we've invaded countries.
Well, we invaded Iraq. Yeah.
Did we have any true rationale to invade Iraq? There were no weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Anyone who dared to question that, you got in a lot of hot water in this country back then. I would say what those arguments miss is they fail to see a moment in time that is as clear and stark a moral line as we saw, as I said, in World War I or that we saw on the eve of World War II. Watching Biden and Zelensky standing together in Kyiv is this incredible study in contrast, right? I think Biden had already been elected to the Senate for like 5 years before Zelensky was even born. So he's a young guy and an old guy.
29 years old.
Zelensky's in his classic, drab green army outfit. Biden is wearing the classic Washington Power suit and the long coat. And I think they are an incredible study in contrast, but I think they, like Churchill and FDR, understand this is a moment. This is when the arsenal of democracy, as they call it, has to come forward and has to play a role. And I think anyone, Republican Congress, China, India, even South Africa, anyone who allows the past to obscure the clarity of the present risks being on the wrong side of history.
We're talking with GBH News analyst Charlie Sennett, a founder and editor of the Ground Truth Project. Charlie, you've been over, as we said before, to Ukraine. There's different parts of the country, obviously, and not the same everywhere, but are people like going to school? Are they going to work? You see these shots of rubble, and you mentioned bringing the generator to the newsroom because people don't have water and heat and electricity, we've been hearing, but is there any normal life over there?
There is. It's one of the most stunning contrasts when you're in Kyiv in particular or in Lviv, which is even more stable and further to the west and more secure and further from the shelling. life does go on. There are restaurants that are open, and people continue. I think I mentioned when I came back, you can be in a restaurant, and there will be a strike somewhere on the power grid, and the power will go out, and people will just keep on dining. And they don't even lose a beat. I didn't see this, but a New York Times colleague talked about going to see the Philharmonic in a subway station platform where the same thing happened. They were playing a piece of music, lights go out, the orchestra played on. And I think that that is a conscious image Ukraine wants to put forward. We will not be deterred. We will not stop. Even if we are freezing cold, even if we are miserable, we're going to continue with our lives as best we can. And in Kyiv, in particular, there's a way to do that. Then you get out to the areas that are on the front line of the war. And it stuns you physically to look at a war zone where there are trench lines, where there is rubble that looks vaguely like Dresden.
Yes.
And you think, this is Europe in the year 2023. And look where we are. And I think the thing that really struck me is seeing a field, a forest, and on the edge of the field, I suddenly realized that is a trench line. And there were soldiers with their heads up above the parapet of the trench line. This is 2023 in Europe.
You know, Charlie used the term arsenal of democracy about a minute ago, and you meant it in a figurative way. I mean it in a literal way. I am somebody who has no military background, knows nothing about weaponry or war, but am still wildly unhappy about what we haven't done to defend Zelensky and the Ukrainians. And obviously, I know what the response is, the nuclear threat, you go too far. But essentially, that argument can be used to not do anything for Ukraine, because this might be the thing that provokes Putin. I'm getting a sense, anecdotally, I haven't done any sort of hard number research, that a growing number of people who have expertise in these issues in the United States believe we do have to arm them more heavily, that we do have to cross certain lines we weren't willing to cross months ago, because ultimately, particularly if China gets involved in this, even if it's not on the surface but below the surface, Ukraine's at great risk. Do you get the same sense that we're willing to move the needle further than we were 6 months ago?
I do. I think this war has changed its complexion in the last 3 months. As Russia has telegraphed that it's preparing for a major offensive, Zelensky came to Washington, convinced the president, convinced the White House, convinced most of Congress, and I guess most importantly, convinced the Pentagon, we need not only defensive weapons, we need offensive weapons. We're going to have to go on the offense to really consolidate the gains we have. And to do that, they're going to need tanks. And that was why they wanted the tanks so badly. So the German Leopard tanks that are going to be going to Ukraine via Poland are really important. They're the best tanks that are made for offense. Same with the M1 tanks that we have provided, finally, and that they're going to take a little while to get there.
But these, and to train them and how to use them.
They're complex.
But they want planes, too.
And that we haven't done yet, and that's going to have to come. And why we didn't think to do that up front with some of the F-16s that we could have provided via Poland is going to be proven in history to have been, I think, a mistake.
Yeah, one last thing about the weaponry, again, I would reiterate, about which I know nothing. Why do we not train Ukrainian fighters in all of the weaponry that we might be giving them down the line, rather than waiting to make a decision on a tank or a plane, and then, you know what I mean? And then letting...
Yeah.
And if we don't end up giving them something, so they wasted some time in training, the beauty, I would argue, of my approach is if we do give them X or Y, they're ready to use it, rather than 6 months away.
Two reasons. One is I think there are very few bodies they can sacrifice from the front lines. They can't pull back a unit to focus on the future. They're in too much of a fight for survival. That's one. Second, I do think there is select covert training going on that we might not know about. And I don't have that reported factually,
I understand.
But it certainly makes sense. And you raise a really good point, which is they have to get the training going early before we get the delivery of the weapons.
So, Charlie Sennett, we've asked you about when this ends before, and I think, I don't know if you said it, but certainly other people have said it ends when Putin decides it ends, which she seems to not be inclined to do at the moment. And you listen to Ukrainians, Zelensky, we're not going to negotiate about giving some of our land away. So what do the smart people think is going to happen here?
There was an interesting comparison to the war in Korea that was written today. I think it was in the Washington Post, basically saying the way this ends is not with a peace agreement, but with a ceasefire. And that's what happened in 1953 as the two sides of the war in Korea became exhausted and there was a stalemate. Now we can look back on that and we can say 70 years later, it held. And look at what happened. North Korea aligned itself with the Sino-Soviet pact, Russia and China. And South Korea aligned itself with the United States. Which country's doing better?
Yeah.
This South Korea is a modern miracle of an economy. It really is. It's extraordinary success as an economy. And I think the world is looking at this moment, and maybe the most interesting comparison of where we are is total stalemate. That won't forge a peace deal, maybe, because I don't think Ukraine will ever give up the dream that it should have all of its land. And they
including Crimea from a decade ago.
Right, and from 2014. And Russia would say, hey, we have a historical connection to this land, and we have some rights here, too. And I don't think we have to wait for a peace agreement, because I don't see it happening, but a ceasefire needs
okay.
to happen.
We only have 30 seconds left. And yeah. if that were to happen, and that would be spectacular, I think, does the rest of the world welcome Putin back to meetings on the east side of New York City at the UN? Is it like nothing happened? I mean, one day you read a story also in the Washington Post how it's not absurd to think he'd be tried for war crimes. On the other hand, they cut a deal, there's a ceasefire, and are we back to, as they say in Latin, status quo ante, like things never happened?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I know that we're in a pivotal moment. China's put forward some terms of a possible way to start a ceasefire. They're pretty hollow, frankly, given China's body language, the way it's carried itself. But I do think we have to find the way to stop the killing. The war is killing.
I couldn't agree more.
It's a killing machine, and the absurdity of it is what can propel two sides to at least get to a ceasefire, which, no matter what the end game is, I think should be welcomed by the world.
Charlie, let me just say, you're doing wonderful work at the Ground Truth Project. It's unfortunate you couldn't afford two T-shirts. But
I got you an extra large.
Okay.
Yep, you got that there.
Sort of bugging me the whole 20 minutes, but I guess...
No, it's there. There are two, and okay. I do expect you to wear that proudly.
I will. Absolutely. Now that I know I have one, I will.
Jim is big into showing up in T-shirts, Charlie.
Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank
you. Thanks for the work of your colleagues.
Congratulations on 10 amazing years.
Thanks a lot.
We've been speaking with Charlie Sennett, a GBH news analyst, founder, editor of the Ground Truth Project. We're very grateful to him for his presence. By the way, on Monday we're going to be joined by two Ukrainians living in Boston. We've had them on a number of times on the show, and they're going to talk to us about their perspective from what they hear from their families and friends that are still in Ukraine. But coming up, there is a new group of wombats taking over PBS, and they're going to be taking over BPL in just a couple of seconds. If you're here, you might want to see someone named Zeke, who I believe is back in the audience there somewhere. We will talk with the executive producers of this terrific new show. Marissa Walski and Marcy Gunther are of the new GBH PBS show, Work It Out Wombats. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming both at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews. Thank you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews and at facebook.com/GBHnews. This month, PBS Kids and GBH launched a new animated preschool series, Work It Out Wombats. It follows a playful trio of marsupial siblings who live with a grandmother in a fantastical treehouse apartment complex called the Treeberhood. Here's a little sound.
Why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, I was having a dream about meatballs. Oh, and this goat called Mr. Goat came over and...
Why don't we skip to the part about Snout?
So then Malik woke me up and Snout was gone.
I see. How can we work this out?
I should have said, by the way, Wombat Zeke lost his beloved stuffed animal, Snout, and that's what led to that conversation. We're joined now by Marissa Wolski and Marcy Gunther, executive producers of a brand new show from GBH and PBS Kids. You said that already, Jim. Just debuted. It's called Work It Out, Work It Out, Work It Out, Wombat. I know I got the tune wrong, but that is the song. You can catch episodes on... It really isn't, but you can catch episodes on GBH2, or you can stream online at pbskids.org. And in a couple of minutes, we were told, we don't know this for sure, that Zeke is somewhere in the library, and we'll try to find him at some point. Welcome to you both, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Very exciting to be here.
Yeah, I went down the Work It Out Wombats rabbit hole last night, and I had a blast.
So did I.
It was really fun, and we're happy to report that Snout was indeed found, so that's very good.
Yes.
Marissa and Marcy, why don't we start with Marissa? Explain what this show is all about.
Sure. So at the heart of this show is community and teaching kids computational thinking. So you got the community with the Treeberhood, and the Treeberhood houses all walks of animals. And you've got computational thinking where the everyday problems that the wombats and their friends solve using CT. And CT sounds like kind of a really intimidating word, but it isn't. Computational thinking is really just an organized and systematic way to solve problems using a toolbox of skills from computer science.
Okay, so why a wombat? Of course, I could have said why an aardvark not too long ago, but why a wombat?
So that's a great question. We looked at probably every animal in the animal kingdom when we were thinking about what animal we wanted to be the star of this show. We looked at cats and dogs, and we feel like, you know what, they've gotten plenty of play in children's television, and, you know, the aardvark, he's, you know, had a long and successful career. What's an animal that really hasn't had its due and really embodies sort of the joyful and playful and energetic spirit that we really wanted to embody this show with? And we came across wombats. And I have to say, the first time I heard the word wombat, I thought it was a bird, only to come to find out it's a adorable and fuzzy marsupial.
Does that mean you have a pocket? Is that what I don't even know what a marsupial
means.
Yeah,
they do.
They have a pocket. Okay.
They have pockets in the back, and they can run up to 25 miles an hour. They like to roll into balls, and we really wanted to embody that sort of kinesthetic, fast kind of, you know, think on your feet kind of energy with this series. And we thought, aha, that's our animal. So.
And Marissa Wolski, I think these are children's voices that are playing the part, or doing the voices for the wombats.
Yeah,
absolutely. We have sound, actually, from it. Here's this behind-the-scenes thing, which is fabulous. That's available to people, right?
Yes.
The behind-the-scenes thing is great. 3 minutes, 4 minutes. Sound of the kids who voice the characters. And by the way, that's important. Kids voicing kids, not adults. Like moving their voice in such a way that, you know what I mean. In any case, here's a little bit from behind the scenes.
I'm Ian, and I play Malik.
Wee!
I'm Mia, and I play Sadie.
Yeah!
And I'm Rain, and I play Zeke.
I love that idea!
Work It Out Wombats is about these three wombats and also Grandma Super.
Thumbs up, buttercups!
They explore and have adventures, and they love to work together to solve problems.
So why do you decide? I mean, there are like on The Simpsons, by the way, as we know, there's a very famous actress who plays a little kid. Why'd you decide you do kids playing kids rather than adults doing kids?
So they bring a naturalness that adults sometimes can do, but often not. It hasn't been so many years before since they faced those same problems. So they can really access that when they're actors, you know, when they're in their voice acting. Yeah, and you know, the challenge, of course, is they get older and the animated characters stay the same age and we have to recast, but it's really worth that.
You know, we've elevated negativity on the show to an art form.
Yeah.
We really have, and Marjorie's just as responsible as I am. You two look so happy.
Yeah.
Is that BS or is that...
No. Yeah, I would say, you know, congratulations on your 10th anniversary.
Thank you very much.
Marissa and I have been at GBH, I think, collectively almost 50 years.
Oh my goodness.
So, you know, just...
So how much fun is it to work on an animated show like this?
And I think we've just been so lucky to get the chance to work at GBH and make meaningful media for kids for as long as we have. You know, I got my start on Arthur in Arthur's mailroom.
So
my first job was answering all of Arthur's fan mail.
That's
back
fabulous.
When we thought we could answer it all and then realized that this show was going to be too big of a hit to answer each kid individually. And, you know, Marissa, you have a long and storied career as well.
Yeah, well, tell us about your long and storied career, and then I want to ask you about these kids.
Sure. So yeah. I started on a show called Long Ago and Far Away hosted by James Earl Jones. Yes. And then worked my way up the ranks and did Carmen Sandiego, both Word of the World and Word in Time and Zoom and Design Squad. And, you know, I think, again, as Marcy said, we're really lucky that, you know, GBH invests so much in the development of the media we produce. Like, working at Wombats was 8 years in the making.
Wow.
Yes.
So how old are these kids whose voices we hear, and how did you find them? Did you go to, you know, Kids Family Theater or something? How old are they?
So the ages they play are 3, 4, and 5.
How old are the actors?
And then the actors range from like 9 to 12.
Oh, okay, yeah. So they're pretty young. And did they come in an audition? Were there hundreds of kids trying to get this role?
Mm-hmm.
And where'd they come from?
Go ahead. Sorry.
What do you care where they came from?
Because there are lots of people who want to get their kids on TV, Jim.
So our wonderful animation studio, Pipeline Studios, we're a partner in this production. They're based in Toronto. So the kids all live in the greater Toronto area.
Okay, so they advertised it up there.
Yes.
And the kids came in and tried
out.
And
we had hundreds of auditions and, you know, just winnowing it down until we found our three perfect Wombats.
See,
you know,
life might have been different for you, Jim, if you'd auditioned for one of these shows when you were a kid.
I was on Sally Star's show when I was a kid in Philadelphia.
Oh, is that
right?
I thought you did that something about a cow jumping over the moon.
No,
wasn't
I was in Cowboy on the Moon, too, but we shouldn't talk about that now. But I am available.
Were you the cowboy or the moon?
The thing I'm a little... What do you think? I'm a little disappointed because we were told not only would we get you two, we were told Zeke would actually show up today. No Zeke. I'm supposed to be walking through the crowd. Obviously, no Zeke.
No,
that's a little disappointment.
Zeke is about to appear.
Says who?
Jim.
Oh, my God.
Here comes Zeke.
Who can't make it through the doorway.
Oh, my gosh. Hi, Zeke.
Is there any other show that can go from talking about Ukraine to introducing a wombat to an audience at the, whatever this is, the Boston Public Library? That's a little deal. What takes 8 years? By the way, I don't mean to, you know, in any way diminish. I watched the first episode. It was fabulous. It was really fun. What takes 8 years to develop a show like this?
So 2 of those years are production. You know, producing 40 episodes is an enormous task. 5 of those years were development. You know, making sure that the creative was right, making sure the curriculum was right, finding the money.
I guess that is a big thing.
You know what I thought was interesting, too? You got the three little wombats are living with their grandmother. So is this about showing there's all kinds of families? And I guess one of the best friends, their parents, is two moms.
Two moms, yes.
So there's part of that.
So we really, in all the shows that we create, want to create shows that reflect the lived reality of our audience, the kids and the families that are watching.
Oh, so
them.
It won't be playing in Florida. That's too bad.
and the diversity of lived experience in this country. So we knew it was paramount to create a show that really reflected all kinds of families, characters with all kinds of physical abilities that spoke different languages, that, you know, had different family structures, like I said, and... You know, to do that takes a really big team, and that is part of what took some of the 8 years, or the 6 years, we like to say, is really finding a team that could help us develop this really rich, inclusive, and diverse world, and building a team that reflected this
You know, Marcy,
world.
When I said a second ago I won't be playing in Florida, I didn't really mean it as a joke. Do you people have to think about the different jurisdictions where PBS goes, which is everywhere, and decide what might not be tolerated, sadly, by an opportunistic governor or mayor? Or
luckily, that's not our job.
You're nodding it, but does somebody?
Somebody at GBH does, and luckily we don't have to do that. Our job is to make the best media to serve the most children.
I know you don't want to talk about this, I can tell, but doesn't that make you sad?
Does make us sad, yeah.
Okay, well, that's the end of that topic.
And I think, you know, we have an incredible team. We have our creative producers, Dr. Darlene and Kareem Edouard. They both have academic background in STEM and culture and inclusion, and really work together to create a world that really felt like it could represent all kinds of families and family structures.
Can you give us a story or two that you found particularly great amongst the first episodes? We saw the first one, but pick a storyline and tell us what the moral of that story is, or lesson was.
You know, and something we've heard from parents is they love that the show is not just about problem solving, but it's about problem solving in the context of managing your emotions, but which, let's face it, can use to work on. And it's, we think that's such a valuable thing to teach kids and their parents. And there's an episode that really, I think, has resonated with a lot of people called Brother Day, where Malik, one of the oldest wombat, has set up a whole day for Zeke of activities they're going to do together. And he didn't really take what Zeke wanted to do into account. So it's all his favorite things. It's reading his Kaylee Kuwama comic books. It's drinking grapefruit juice. And it's all about how Zeke is not having a good time. And he kind of has a little bit of a meltdown, rightfully so. And Malik has to kind of come to the understanding that, you know, when you're trying to design something for someone, you really have to think about what do they want. It's not just about what I want. And I think that was a story that was written by one of our writers, and we have a really big writing team, and from something that was from his lived experience. And I think that has really resonated with a lot of people because they see themselves in that story, and that's something that happened to them.
Marissa, you know, I can't think of the guy's name, but there's one of the most famous ventriloquists in the country who I had on television when I was at New England Cable News a bunch of years ago. And he had a dummy on his lap, and it was a live show. We went to commercial break, and on my honor, this is true. This guy was so good that when we went to the commercial, what I often will say to a guest, is there anything else you want to bring up? I turned to the dummy, and on my honor, and started to say, is there anything? And the point was, it became so lifelike, even in the maybe 6 minutes. What kind of relationship do you have? I don't mean this as a joke, with the three wombats.
Yeah, I mean, they have incredible personalities,
right.
And they're different from the actors who play them.
Yeah.
So I think we relate actually more to the
characters,
and when we actually interact with the kids, I mean, we just saw the actor who played Zeke, and he was wearing this little leather jacket, and his hair was like that, and I'm like, wait a minute, you're three.
That's
oh, my goodness, look at Zeke making the way through the crowd there. He had to squish through the door. What is Zeke made out of?
He's inflatable.
Yeah. Okay, that's why I could squish through the door.
Yeah.
And the good news is probably only like 400 degrees in that suit, so I'm sure he or she feels really comfortable. So when is this? When do people see this? When do they find it and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so it's on now. It's on GBH2 every day at 10:30. It's on
It's on GBH Kids at 9:30, and it's streaming free on PBS Kids video app and pbskids.org.
Did parents, when someone's 3 to 6, which is your target audience, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming kits and educational material and all that stuff is available to people. I assume the notion is you don't just plop your 4-year-old in front of the television. You plop yourself next to your 4-year-old.
Well, some of us have plopped the kid in front
of the
TV.
Well, I know we have. That's why I'm asking the question. But is that that's obviously
the gold standard is creating a show that parents want to watch with their kids.
Yeah.
Our caregivers. You know, it really is. And I think we also create lots of materials that they can enhance the experience they have watching the show. We're creating an app. There are materials for educators on PBSLM. There are games they can play on pbskids.org and the PBS Kids Games app. So we really want to make sure that this experience, you know, goes through every part of kids' lives.
But, you know, as a bad mother who plopped my children in front of PBS shows many times, I mean, you can't underestimate how helpful that is when you're coming home from work and you're in a frenzy and the kids have got to eat, you're going to do whatever, that you can have them do something that's good for them. You know, for a half hour of great TV or half an hour. I mean, I maybe more on some occasions. But, you know, it's a great service for the harried parent. It really is.
I just have one last question about the construct of this thing. I assume from the one we saw that there are finite pieces so that the little 4-year-old doesn't lose his or her interest. Is that how's the show constructed, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, it comes from the stories and the characters. We sort of start there, and we have writers pitch us ideas, and then we try to marry it with the computational thinking. What learning can we apply to this story, and kind of work from there. It's not formulaic in that, like, you know, in every 11-minute story, this happens and this, you know, some shows are built with that kind of structure. Our stories are really story-based. So kind of anything can happen in a Wombat story.
And we mentioned the other day when our new boss and your new boss, Susan Goldberg, the new head of GBH, was here, that was the day that Mayor Wu declared it, what's up with Wombat Day? So what happens when a city declares it that day? You get a plaque or what happens?
Yeah, we got a lot. I think there's a certificate, and we got a lot of attention this week, which is really always nice.
By the way, the beauty is Zeke hasn't been able to move in about 12 minutes. You notice? It's really rather sad, actually. Yeah.
Just well, listen, congratulations.
First episode was great.
On a wonderful show that's a lot of fun and very educational, just exactly what you want from PBS Kids.
We've been speaking is there a website also for the show? I'm sorry. We
should ask PBSKids.org.
Great, okay.
Okay, we have been speaking with Marissa Walsky and Marcy Gunther, executive producers of Work It Out Wombats, the latest kids animated show from GBH and PBS Kids. And I'll repeat what we just said. You can watch episodes on GBH2. You can stream them online at pbskids.org. The website Jim just asked about again is pbskids.org, correct? And did I miss any place else to watch GBH2 and...
GBH Kids.
GBH Kids. Okay. Thank you very, very much for being
really
here. Thank you very much for creating a really terrific show. Coming up, GBH's Callie Crossley is here. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7, GBH broadcasting from the Boston Public Library and streaming online at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews. We'll be right back.
Trusted, local, news. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR, what matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live at the Boston Public Library. Stream at youtube.com/GBHnews and facebook.com/GBHnews. Live Music Friday with a fabulous drum line that's probably going to get us kicked out of the library. It's about 25 minutes away. They are fabulous. And at 2 o'clock, in honor of the 10th anniversary of Boston Public Radio, we will be serving cake from Flower Bakery to everybody who was kind enough to join us today.
There is no better cake around.
They're pretending they're not here for the cake. In any case, that's why I'm here. We're joined now by GBH's Callie Crossley. Callie hosts Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, obviously, which you can catch Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6. She's also the host of Basic Black. That airs Friday at 7:30. You can also hear Callie commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. Hello, Callie Crossley.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marcy.
Hello.
Callie Crossley.
Hello.
So, you know, Callie, we often bemoan the fact that it's very difficult to get convictions in sexual assault cases, rape cases. We certainly bemoan the fact that it's really hard to get it when the person that's the perpetrator is a rich, famous, and powerful person. But I think the extended sentencing of Harvey Weinstein and also R. Kelly... these guys are going to be in jail for a very, very long time, and they were both really very powerful men, one in music and one in the movies.
I think the only thing that we can say about it that, you know, remains negative is that why did it take so long? Because these were open secrets in both of their cases, and there was a lot of evidence out there. But, again, as we both know, it's very difficult for women to come forward, and when they do, they are often not believed. So, I mean, it was intense that... Let's give a nod, you and I and all of us here, to the reporting that, you know, evidenced the Harvey Weinstein sexual crimes to begin with, and then that encouraged other women to come forward. It is really hard to come forward to know that, A, you may not be believed, and that's the most likely thing, and then on top of that, they're going to drag you back through everything because that's the case. You got to make the case. And I don't know if people... have read some of the details of
Harvey Weinstein.
I have. And
it's
gruesome.
It's beyond.
It's really gruesome. Beyond. And by the way, that movie, as she said, you'll love it. It documents the New York Times going after Harvey Weinstein, how difficult it was, and how the reporters were really in danger, I think it's fair to say, for going after Harvey Weinstein. And by the way, since I used to be in newspapers, it shows you how difficult it is to get these stories. So it's a great, it's worth your time.
Right. By the way, I'm sorry, Kelly, go ahead, you go ahead.
And with regard to R. Kelly, there was another reporter in Chicago who had been writing about this forever, and nobody would ever pick up on the stories. And then Don Porter did that documentary, which was very helpful. And it, you know, and then you know, Gail did the interview in which he lost his mind.
Oh my God,
Gail King.
Yes.
So all of that brought new attention. But I'll remind you that even when Gail King did the interview, she also interviewed some of the women in his circle, the young women in his circle, and they denied up and down that he had ever done anything. And it was only after he was charged the first time and seemingly safely put away that several of them came forward and said, yes, in fact, we were, you know, kidnapped, in effect, and kept here. And, you know, he abused us.
Yeah, young woman that I believe was 14 at the time that he made this video of the two of them together.
This is his goddaughter.
Yeah. Yes, she denied that she was the person, and then she did a 180 because I assume because she was so afraid.
Well, absolutely. That's what I'm saying. I think after that first, you know, conviction, then I think, you know, some people felt a little bit more comfortable because after those years of not being believed and all this evidence and nobody doing anything, would you come forward? Of course not.
You know, by the way, you said they're going to be in prison a long time. The good news, doing the math, they're both going to die in prison unless some miraculous thing happens on appeal, both Weinstein and Kelly. And I have to say, you know, you talk about how hard it is. This morning I was reading a quote that I've seen about 50 times from one of the lawyers, and I'm one who believes everybody's entitled to representation. One of the lawyers for Weinstein said of Jennifer Newsom, who's the First Lady of California, quote, this is in front of the jury, just another bimbo who slept with Harvey Weinstein to get ahead. That's what she had to endure in addition to, and by the way, the counts brought by her on her behalf, they did not find Weinstein guilty. You know what's really satisfying to me, and that may be the wrong word, so maybe I should apologize in advance. I'm not sure what the right word is. When you're a master of the universe, and Weinstein was the ultimate master of his universe, R. Kelly maybe not as much, but still a pretty big deal in his industry. So the juries come in, they're sentenced, and they're aware at that moment they're never going to have another moment of freedom in their whole lives when they had freedom on steroids. There was nothing they couldn't do. There's nobody they couldn't do it to. And the reason I'm even bringing that up, beyond the fact that I find that very satisfying considering their crimes, is I wonder, in such high-profile cases where they can afford the best, most skillful, most manipulative, whatever it is, lawyers, does it serve as a deterrent effect to the next Harvey Weinstein and the next R. Kelly? What do you think?
Well, as I have written about this many times in commentaries, these guys, particularly of this certain age and space, were wont to say, I didn't rape anybody. They would, if you ask them now, and I don't believe it's out of defense of going to jail. They really believe that the way that they operated was not rape. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
This consensual,
is, this
as
is,
they
this
said.
This is business as usual. What are you talking about?
Casting couch.
Right. I didn't rape anybody.
Yeah.
And so I don't know is the answer to that. The only thing that I can say that I think is very positive is we've just acknowledged the 5 years of Me Too. And hey, it took a while, but here's two big fish that went down.
What do you think about the deterrent effect? You've covered a million trials, criminal trials. What do you think about the deterrent effect on the next Weinstein, for example?
Well, I certainly think the Me Too movement has made men a lot more nervous about the kind of things that they do in the workplace. So I hope it's had some impact when you see very powerful people like this. But I don't really know.
I don't really know.
Yeah. But I do know, and this makes me very happy, is that women have a place to go now to complain.
Yeah.
Which when we were young, Callie, you didn't have a place to complain. You just kind of hoped you ran faster.
Yeah.
And now you can go in and you can say so-and-so. And you're sticking your neck out, and it may not work out, but at least there is some place to complain.
Well, also, the latest Pew results with regard to this issue found that most people believe now, that's most Americans, not most Americans who have been abused, believe now that there, in fact, is quite a bit of abuse, particularly going on in the workplace. And they believe that women are mostly not believed.
Yeah.
So that's a huge leap from, you know, and you figure some of these people will end up on juries at some point, right? Right? So maybe we're a little bit ahead. It's very tough, though, because it's obviously intimate. And, you know, you need witnesses of the sort that can have evidence that cannot be disputed. And if you didn't, in that moment of terror, say to yourself, let me call my friend and tell my friend what exactly happened so at least I have some contemporaneous evidence in that way. I mean, who's thinking about all of that? You're just trying to get your mind back together.
Yeah, you know? And I also think it's I always think that if 25 people said that Jim Browdy had robbed a 7-Eleven, they say, well, okay, 25 people said the same thing.
Yeah.
Almost 25 people accused Donald Trump of improper sexual advances, grabbing them,
Bill Cosby.
Right?
Bill Cosby, I think.
How hundreds. Many, hundreds. You know, remember, they covered the whole...
What is it that makes us say, well... those women are all lying.
Because here's the bottom line. People think that sexual harassment and abuse is sex. It's power. And the minute we can make the adjustment to that and understand what that means, then you're in a different space. If you understand that it's power and not sex, I recognize that it is executed through sex, but it is really not about sex.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked about this yesterday. Lynn Jennings went public. She's a famed Olympic runner. She won a million Bonnie Bells around here. She went public with abuse that she suffered at the form of a U.S. former U.S. Olympic coach and Wellesley College coach, a guy named John Babington. We talked about this the other day, that Wellesley College, when confronted by the Globe about this, Jennings claimed, and the Globe confirmed, reading from his story, that Wellesley, rather than fire Babington when the reports of his abuse of runners came forward or reported him to the police, they placed him on unpaid leave for one semester way back in 1998, never formally notified his assistant coaches or the student athletes he had coached over 15 years about these abuse allegations. Wellesley gave a kind of, I was very disappointed in their statement. They said, we're deeply sorry for the pain suffered by our former student as a result of John Babington's sexual misconduct. Wellesley strives to create a safe environment for our students, faculty, and staff and prevent sexual harassment and misconduct with strict policies, blah, blah, blah. They're a women's college, you know, where we're steeped in, I went
and
to a women's college
there,
for a while.
And Cali is a celebrated alum.
So what do you think?
Well, I think a lot of things, but what I will say is nothing, because I'm on the board of trustees at Wellesley College.
Oh.
So I'm very sad that I cannot comment on this for you, because I would love to.
Well, let me ask you this. Here's in general. I mean, I think in general what we're finding now is Harvey Weinstein, women don't get believed for years.
Yeah.
R. Kelly, women don't get believed. Catholic Church, the kids didn't get believed. This case, women, these women didn't get believed, or what? Nothing was done when they even came forward. Larry Nassar, the guy that abused all his gymnasts, the physician that abused all his gymnasts by the dozens and dozens and dozens, Southern Baptist Church. It's like everywhere. So to me, this is my new theory. Well, it's not so new, but there is something about sexual abuse or sexual abuse even of children that people, whether they're in colleges or whether they're in churches, they want to look the other way. You know, what is it? Because there's a common denominator in all these crimes.
The institution matters more than the person. I mean, isn't that...
Well, I also think, let's go back to, you know, what I just said, we haven't focused on this is not sex, this is power. We haven't focused on women are often not believed. Me Too is only 5 years old. There's a lot of things going on here in this stew now that we've come to where people are recognizing that what women had said all along, actually, privately mostly, they weren't public most of the time, that a lot of this is going on. But, you know, that's where we are. We're at a point now where there is public discussion about it. I think that's very important, and that's not going to stop. I think that's very important as well.
Can I just say, since Callie is sort of in a tough spot, obviously, since she's on the board, let me just say, Paula Johnson, who I've met a few times, I am really impressed by, who's the president. She's been the president, I just looked it up, only since 2016.
Yeah.
Having said that, and this is, I won't say this to you because you can't address, I'll say it to Marjorie, I would hope the current administration would decide it's important enough to go back to the late 90s when this decision was made by prior administrations and get to the bottom of it. Because I'm with Marjorie, it is totally unconscionable. They basically let loose a predator on students. And it's just, it's in any case.
Yeah.
Shouldn't happen.
So let's move on.
We're talking to Callie Crossley.
We're talking to Callie Crossley. Yes, we are. The Root had a great
piece. I know
piece.
You knew, by the way.
Yeah, I did know,
did, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talking about how in domestic violence cases often, you know, you want to buttress your case. If you are the survivor of this, you want to show somebody your injuries. You can often have bruises. But they're talking about how it's harder for black women because they have darker skin. So the black and blue marks can blend in. So what are we doing about this? Or what is somebody doing about this?
Well, this is really interesting because this woman is a researcher, former forensic nurse examiner and researcher at George Mason University. And she realized that instead of using traditional white light, which doesn't do anything on dark skin, that if you use what, quote-unquote, they're calling an alternative light source, such as blue or purple light, it's five times more effective than showing the bruise. So here you have all of these dark-skinned women, a lot of them black women, saying, yes, I was abused, yes, I was injured, and people are using traditional white light saying, really? We don't see anything. And here is an opportunity for them to at least have that piece of evidence. We just discussed it's really important to have all manner of evidence when you are bringing forth a case like this. This is could be incredibly important. They're going to test it. They're going to run trials on it to see that it's as effective as it has shown itself to be in this, you know, trial and error period. But, I mean, this is game changer.
Yeah, but my reaction to it is exactly what your reaction to Kelly and Weinstein was. What took so long? I mean, this is not exactly exotic science. It's not that I could do it.
Yes, but okay, but let's go to something more common that people would think about. The coloration, the map that you use to take photos is based on white people.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Okay. That's so, you know, I'm always at a disadvantage having these situations when I'm either doing makeup or being lit or whatever. And so the first question, thank God, I have a great makeup artist, Phoebe Ramlew, who knows how to do
black people.
We love Phoebe.
It is amazing. You look one way without Phoebe on TV, and I'm not just you. Me too. And you look another way.
Hey, exactly. She does the men, too, by the way.
Oh, my God. So. Talk about a transformation.
My point is, white people. She does black people very well, and it's something different.
Yeah.
You know, you have to pay attention to the skin tones and all of that. It's really... anyway.
When you said white people, about 15 years ago, made the mistake because it's a really anxiety-provoking affair, to be on a roast panel of Ernie Bach Jr.
Okay.
And there were about 500 people in the room, and the Andelman brothers and I and a few other people who were not nearly funny enough. All of us were on the thing. And it was hosted by the guy from, I can't think of his name, Joel. What's his name? Joel, tall, thin, great comic. Mikhail, thank you.
He's funny.
So he looks out at the audience. This is at where someplace where the roast fair. And by the way, all the money was going to a good cause. I think it was this thing where he gives instruments to public schools.
Yeah.
The guy, Joel Mikhail, walks to the podium and he looks around. And he says, "Good evening, white people." And he looked through the crowd, other than the band. That's who he was talking to. We're talking to Callie Crossley.
But you know something? In general, as someone who buys a lot of beauty products, that have been for years, I mean, the whole black beauty products thing is not that. I mean, it's fairly new.
You mean in terms of it's getting the kind of space.
Skin,
and,
hair.
Yes, it's been around, but getting the kind of space in Sephora and every place else.
Yeah.
But here is why.
I love Sephora.
Here is why.
Do you like Sephora?
Yes, of course I love Sephora.
I love Sephora.
I'm making another point. Here is why Rihanna is a multi-billionaire now, because her lip gloss goes for everybody. Her main lip gloss, that was a major million-dollar, multi-million-dollar seller, you can wear it and I can wear it. It does different things because of the pH in our skin. But, you know, Rihanna, you never have to sing again just based on that.
Yeah. Well, she looked pretty good however pregnant she was at the Super Bowl.
She's singing at the Oscars, too, I just heard this morning on the way in.
But
so speaking of singing, there's a story we read about how it's the ultimate status symbol to have a ticket to the Renaissance Tour of Beyonce. Yes. And the story starts with, and this is
crazy, isn't it?
One person bought a ticket for a mere $3,757 with a $556 fee. So I just came up with an idea that
they did get to sit in the stage for that, though.
Fine. It's $4,300 to go to the damn concert. Almost everything. There was a guy whose name I forget for the moment. I almost went to see at one of the places on Washington Street. I was going to go by myself, and it was $420 for a guy who's great, but almost nobody knows.
Yes.
The place sold out kind of thing. Why don't these performers to address the absurd? I mean, Bruce Springsteen, when he was asked about the absurdity with tickets before Taylor Swift, and they were going for $5,000 a person, said, well, it's either we're going to make it, the artists, or the secondary market is going to secondary market is what we call it? Yeah. Why don't these artists make sure that through their tours they do at least a few free performances on Boston Common, in Central Park, wherever the hell it is, to basically say, we know most people can't afford $4,300 to go see me perform. No?
I would like the answer to that myself. Now, I will say, Beyonce's not doing free concerts on the Common unless I've heard something different. However, she has a billion charities.
She does have a billion.
A billion charities and that she supports wholeheartedly. I mean, small businesses particularly. She's got big on that. A lot of small businesses were almost crashing, and she came in and swooped in with, you know, the money that she does, and it's made a difference. So that's, I guess, how she responds. But I'm not speaking for her.
I didn't think you were speaking for her, actually.
And on top of that, I would not even try to get a ticket because I think you're going to have to crawl over glass to get it based on this.
My daughter was up. I think I've told you. My younger daughter was up till 3 o'clock in the morning to get Springsteen tickets, and we're basically sitting on the roof of the Garden.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm thrilled we're gone,
but
it's practically nosebleed and then some kind of thing. So,
well, they were talking about trying to break up the monopoly when they had those hearings.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's never
going to
happen.
It's hopeless. I mean,
it's never going to happen.
Because,
and here's the other thing that I think is also going to factor into this with regard to the artist not saying anything. And now that you can, you know, Spotify and this and that with, you know, they do get paid. But, you know, there's a lot of music out there that's available for which I'm sure they're not getting a kickback. Or if they are, it's not what they would get if they were on tour or whatever. So this is their moment.
So they make their money.
This is where they make their money.
They do.
You know, so.
Okay. Yeah. Now, let's talk about cauliflower sandwiches at Chick-fil-A. I don't know. I mean, I've never been to Chick-fil-A.
It's right down the street, you know.
I know.
Well,
they were nasty to gay people.
Right. They were really nasty.
That's why I've never been.
Have they apologized officially?
Theoretically, they have. The CEO did. I'll check it out in a second.
No, but I haven't been for that.
But
reason.
I guess if I were going to go to Chick-fil-A, I don't know that would be the place I'd go get a cauliflower sandwich. I mean, what do you think?
Well, I think that plant-based trend is huge, and I think they're very smart to do it.
You think
and
so?
The way that they are describing how they do it actually sounds pretty daggone good because they're marinating it in a mild buffalo style sauce.
Yeah,
and then they're hand breading and pressure cooking until crispy. That's going to be really tasty.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
they do have, people tell me, wonderful chicken sandwiches at Chick-fil-A. Everybody says that they're great. So maybe they'll do a great job on cauliflower sandwiches.
By the way, we weren't going to announce this, but the cakes we're going to serve for our 10th anniversary at the end of the show, cauliflower based. Very interesting.
Yeah, you're laughing, but let me just tell you, all the gluten-free stuff that you can get now that you cannot tell.
It's good.
You cannot
tell. You are right.
Wait a second.
You
know. Tracy Chang, when she was here the other day from Pago and made that chocolate cake that she gave to the whole audience, wasn't the second...
I wasn't here.
Oh, you weren't here for
that?
No, it was delicious.
We had three chefs nominated.
It was delicious.
Were you here for that?
I was here.
Yeah, three chefs nominated in the semifinals of the James Beard thing.
Yeah.
We had... who do we have here? We had Rachel Miller from Nightshade Noodle in Lynn, which is unbelievable. Yeah. Tracy Chang from Pagu in Cambridge. And Maria Rondeau, who with her husband Juan Ma Calderon do Celeste and La Royale and that sort of thing.
You know why Jim has all these great restaurants?
Yeah, you get free food. I mean, I'm not trying to fool anybody.
He was getting free dinners three nights a week at Greater Boston. It was a scam.
Oh, all right.
Scam.
Okay,
by the way, that's why I left Greater Boston. They said no more meals. I said no more show. That's the way it works, my friends. See you later.
Okay.
So speaking of show, what are you doing this weekend, Kelly Crossley?
Our first segment is about guaranteed income or universal income, which has been debated many times. Many critics about, you know, it's not going to work. You don't give no strings attached cash payments to people because it just doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. Well, guess what? There's now a whole organization of mayors who are, whether or not the federal government has decided they're going to do that, have been moving with these pilot programs. There are two local ones
here. Chelsea and Cambridge, right?
Yes, that's right. And they're done very well.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have to say that just to hear the people talk about what it means to them, as one of the folks in the story said, you know, you all don't know what a little bit of help can mean in my life. It means a huge amount. And so I think this is the way that it's going to end up going from, you know, local, perhaps in a grassroots movement, back to federal, because we're about to lose the food benefits for COVID next Thursday. That's going to be huge, the pandemic food benefits that were the extra ones that went to people who got SNAP. You know, it's... this is bad.
And
it's
didn't
bad
they use
here.
It? Didn't they find in these studies that people
yes,
do use
this
it
is
for
Chelsea.
Food?
That's exactly what for
rent
necessity.
Or for a necessity.
Yeah. There is research. There is real research.
Yeah, they're not
where
going
they
over to gamble at the
no,
you know,
they're
casino.
Using it for food and yeah. shelter. That's what's happening. And then the second thing we're doing is the Black Comic exhibit at the Stone Gallery at BU, which I have to say, I do a lot of gallery exhibits around the country, around the world. This is one of the best curated shows ever. It is really interesting because they got in there some of these historic comics that you cannot get from Library of Congress and other special collections, and then they brought it all the way up to current times with what the comics are doing. Huh. It's called Comics as a Medium, Not a Genre. It is so entertaining on every level.
Oh,
I mean,
thank
I just
you for
think,
that.
And it's just well, so well done.
Sounds great.
So please, I want people to
so
do that.
So before, what's your selection today? What are you going to perform?
Oh, I'm performing nothing.
You're really disappointing.
We got so many texts
a lot of people.
About you last week. They
maybe
said,
more than ever.
Callie has a second career as a gospel singer.
Do you all have any sense of, you know, spontaneity? That's what that was about. Though, my Walter Mitty dream was to be a local lounge singer.
Is it really true?
Yes. And so, you know how you like to say, you say you like to get the free food.
Oh,
so
I
my little
you.
Dream was going to be, you know, I'd just be up there in my cute gown and everything with my band playing. And then, you know, you all would come in and I'd just keep singing, you know.
Well, why don't we wait a second? Why don't we just close our eyes? Imagine we're in that lounge. Everybody close their eyes. Just get in the mood. Here she is.
Well, I'd sing my
Kelly
favorite.
Kelly Crossley. Good. Come on, do something.
All right.
Oh, she said all right.
What a difference a day made. Hey, Jim. 24 little hours. Oh, God, Marjorie. That's what I do.
I love it. Let's hear it.
The sun and the flowers when they're used to be rain. There you go.
Wow.
All right. Woo. Woo. I'm going to that line.
I tell you, very impressive. Kelly Crossley, thank you very much. Kelly Crossley is host of Under the Radar.
By the way, she's loving this, too.
I know. Well, she's got a good voice.
She does.
No, no.
I'm
who
laughing
knew?
Because singers everywhere are like, really? Seriously?
Yeah, I don't know.
That was great. Okay,
you're right. On key, Kelly. That's the crucial thing.
No, I'm not.
She's
pitchy.
Host.
Very pitchy.
Oh, yes, you are. No, you're not.
Kelly Crossley is host of Under the Radar, which you can catch Sunday nights right here, 89.7. 6 o'clock. She's also the host of Basic Black, which airs Friday at 7:30. You can also hear her Cali commentaries on Mondays for GBH's Morning Edition. And I think she's got a side gig going here
at the lounge.
As a lounge singer.
The GBH Lounge
okay.
at One Guest Street.
Coming up, we're going to have a live Music Friday performance from the student players at the Hamilton Garrett Center for Music and Arts. They've got a huge fundraiser coming this weekend to raise money, featuring the 10-time Grammy Award-winning vocal group Take Six. We're going to talk with Executive Director Jeremy Grover Flores and someone else whose name you might recognize or voice you might recognize, too. That would be Emmett G. Price III, Reverend Emmett Price III, who's with us usually with Irene for All Revved Up. Well, he's here today to be hosting this Sunday's fundraiser event. He's going to tell us all about it. It's called Make Them Hear You. That is after a quick break. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Mark Regan, live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and at facebook.com/GBH News. We're joined now by Jeremy Grover Flores. She's the executive director of the Hamilton Garrett Center for Music and Arts. It's an after-school music program bringing arts to young people of Boston. Emmett G. Price III, who I used to call Emmett until I heard him on the radio the other morning, referred to as Doctor. So Dr. Price is here as well. He's going to be hosting the Sunday's Make Them Hear You fundraiser for the nonprofit. He's the founding pastor, of course, of the Community of Love Christian Fellowship in Alston, the inaugural dean of Africana Studies at Berklee College of Music. And most importantly to us, he's half of the Revs on our show and on their great podcast. In a couple of minutes, we're going to hear from the center's amazing drumline for a live Music Friday performance. But for now, Jeremy, Emmett, it's great to see you both. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Thank you so much
for coming in. So elaborate on what Jeremy said. What's the deal with the...
Jim said. I'm Jim. She's Jeremy.
You're Jim.
Okay. I'm Jim. That's right.
Well, did I get the names wrong?
That's okay. Close enough.
To a good start. Okay. Tell us about these kids and the whole organization.
Yes. So again, we're the Hamilton Garrett Center for Music and Arts. We're an organization that is proud to have served the greater Roxbury community for over 20 years. Our mission is to preserve and celebrate the music of the African-American musical traditions, and now that has grown to the music of the African diaspora. And we do that through formal music education, providing it to the young people in our community.
And one of the things you often hear that's really kind of sad is that there is not a lot of music education in the public schools anymore, right?
Yes. I mean, with the changes that are happening with arts programming in the public schools, we at Hamilton Garrett are excited and glad to be one of the offerings for the solution of that, providing a safe space where the young people can come and not only grow as musicians, but also have a safe space for them to be and grow creatively.
Emmett Price, what's your connection to this whole deal?
Well, anytime Jeremy calls me and asks me to do something, I do it. I mean, you know, we have an organization here that is led by a phenomenal team of young people who are deeply invested not only in the lives of other young people, but in this great city. And Jeremy is one who is a double alum of Berklee and has done some phenomenal things and wants to reinvest in these young people. And the passion and the compassion and the empathy and the love that you experience here, and you'll hear it through the music, when she calls, I answer.
So tell us a little bit about what Sunday night's going to be. It's not just people here. It's the headliners. I listened to them last night. I'm so excited about it. I cannot see straight. Well, tell us about the whole show.
Well, we're excited, too. This is the 2023 Make Them Hear You fundraiser concert. The Make Them Hear You, as you might know that title from the famous musical Ragtime, that has become the Hamilton Garrett school anthem for over a number of years. And so a few years ago during the pandemic when we were all at home, we decided to start a way where we can come together as a community and celebrate those artists who have really contributed to what we celebrate today as black music. And this Sunday is that. It is our fundraiser concert. We're excited to welcome the Grammy Award winning Take Six.
They're unbelievable.
They're just unbelievable. And they'll be doing a full 1 hour performance. So we're excited about that. But also, most importantly, we're looking forward to honor our Make Them Hear You Award recipient, who is none other than Patrice Rushen.
Who is one of your mentors, right?
Yes.
You know, this woman has had an incredible career. Tell us about her.
You know, Patrice Rushen is known as one of the top jazz pianists of today. But in addition to that, she's had a phenomenal career as a producer, composer, film composer, and artist. You might know some of her great hits like Forget Me Not, Haven't You Heard, songs that have been performed by many artists throughout the time and part of many of our memories that we have as families. So we're really excited to honor Patrice. I had the pleasure of not only meeting her personally, but at Berklee when she was doing some work there as one of their artist ambassadors. She actually took some time and mentored me and really inspired me to pursue the career that I went into, which is composing and arranging. So I'm really, really grateful for this.
You know, Emmett, people that listen to us often think of you as one half of Emmett and Irene. The Revs come in every month.
No, they think of him as one third of Emmett
and Irene. I thought it was a quarter.
Okay, a quarter. You know, I can relate, Emmett. Let me tell you.
That's nice.
I can relate. But anyway, we always mention your affiliation with Berklee, and we know you're a great musician. We know your son's a great musician. But tell us from your perspective about what it means for these kids to get this kind of opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in 1950, the grand dame of Roxbury, Miss Elma Lewis, whose name is entombed in the 1965 Freedom Plaza, created the Elma Lewis School for Fine Arts. And that school ran for 47 years. At the height, it had 700 students and 100 teachers.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, around 1997, it went into demise. What Jeremy and her team are doing at the Hamilton Music and Arts picks up that legacy as started by Mrs. Hamilton and Mrs. Garrett, who's still with us, and is doing such great work that we at Berkeley, particularly in the Africana Studies Division, said we need to partner with you and leverage whatever resources we can to make sure that you are successful. Because this is an intervention that benefits not only the Roxbury community, but also greater Boston, greater Massachusetts, the Commonwealth, and the nation by showing that music, art, and culture is a phenomenal intervention for young people. That what they're passionate about, what they care about, if we can support them and create an infrastructure around them, then we can not only create success for their lives and their future families, but for the communities and neighborhoods from which they come.
You know, so, I'm curious. I'm just going to ask you, because you're not kids anymore. You're pretty young. But did you learn, get introduced to music in school, or was it your family? I'm interested in both of you.
Well, you know, I'm sure Dr. Price and I have a very similar answer to this. My start to music was in the church.
Mm-hmm. In the church.
And with Hamilton Garrett, that was the same start. We started out giving private music instruction in the church Sunday school classroom of Ruth Hamilton and Elta Garrett, and I was actually pleasured to be one of the first students in cohort.
That's incredible.
And
now
you too? Did you start in the church?
Incredible. Church and home. Church and home.
Yeah? Because your parents were big into music or played
a
lot of music?
My father had a huge record collection, which most of it is at my home now. Don't tell him. He's in Los Angeles. But yeah, I mean, we listened to records almost every day. There was a piano in the home. He was a musician, and I would sit on his lap as a young child and then got lessons and started playing classical music until I stopped and went play for the church and played jazz, and the rest is history.
So, Jeremy Groover Flores, what are we going to hear?
Well, you're about to hear our Hamilton Garrett drum line. They just launched as an ensemble in December, so this is one of their first few performances. This group is going to bring you the sound that you would hear at the Southern Classics of the historically black colleges and universities, those halftime shows that everybody gets really excited about, as well as some influence of the New Orleans second line music. They're living out the mission of Hamilton Garrett through the art of drumming, and we're really excited about what you're going to hear. So this is the Hamilton Garrett drumline doing the Hamilton Garrett cadence.
Take it away, drumline. the Hamilton Jets. Jeremy, can you introduce the players to
our
audience?
Yes, absolutely. So right up front playing the quads, we have Marvin. Marvin, wave your hand.
Hey, Marvin.
Right behind. Great. Right next to Marvin, we have Kamani on the snare. We also have Alan, also playing the snare. You just heard him on the solo. Right behind Alan, we have Matthew on the bass drum. We have Amari, our youngest drummer, in the back. And our wonderful sister who's playing the cymbals, Kai. Give it up for Kai.
Wow.
Amazing.
You guys were fabulous. Amazing.
And I
also
have to shout out their head coach, Ezekiel Freeman.
Hey, Ezekiel. You know, that's part of the kind of music you're going to hear. Here's a little sound from another group, which I spent all night last night listening to. They're performing on Sunday. That would be the Alabama-based vocal group, Take Six.
If I could reach the stars, I'd pull one down for you. Shine it on my heart so you can see the truth.
That song is called Change the World. Joining us now via phone from Baltimore, Maryland, is Claude McKnight. Claude is the founder of the legendary 10-time Grammy Award-winning vocal group Take Six. Claude, welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Good now. Thank you.
Claude, thank you so much for joining us. You know, tell us why you guys are really, Take Six is a big deal. You know, everybody knows about them. You guys are big stars. I'm wondering why you are taking, you think it's important to take your time and offer it to this fundraiser for Hamlin Garrett. What's that about?
Well, it's pretty easy for us. We are products of music education, you know. We had a lot of coming up in grade school, junior high school, college. And anytime we can give back and help in that regard, we're there for the cause. Because for me, I'm the oldest in the group. I remember having the ability to have instruments there in the classroom.
And
music lessons right there in the classroom. We didn't have to find it out. We didn't have to find it. It was right there. So anything we can do to bring that back or to bring it into fruition, we're there for.
Hey, Claude, how sick are you of people saying the stuff you did with Paul Simon's about the best stuff in history? You getting sick of that yet or no?
You know, here's the funny thing. Since we just did that recently, I don't mind being relevant, you know.
Oh my God! If people have not heard it, you've got to check it out. Can you give people just a taste of what they'll hear from you and your fellows on Sunday night, Claude?
Well, we'll try to condense, you know, 35 years of of what we do into an hour. So we'll literally give a little bit of music from all aspects of our career, you know, very early on, that a cappella stuff up into, you know, our most recent project, which is actually that Paul Simon thing. So we'll have that on the program as well. So we're just going to have a good time, man.
I want you to know, Claude, while you're speaking, Emmett Price is practically levitating from the stage here. He is so happy about this event.
Huge fan.
Hey, Claude, it's a thrill to meet you. Thanks so much for your time, and we'll see you Sunday night. Thanks so much for being here. Claude McKnight, the founder of the spectacular Take Six.
Yeah, thank you very much, Claude McKnight, for joining us from Take Six, as Jim just said. You know, I just wanted to ask you, there was some precision drumstick work there with these gentlemen. I've never seen that before. Is that a marching band thing? Where does that come from?
Well, a lot of it comes from a number of traditions. One, from the African tradition of speaking through the instrument. So very precise enunciation of patterns, which are communicative, you know, apparatus. And then, of course, through military bands, right? Military bands always march with the soldiers to keep the esprit de corps high. But then the tradition that Jeremy talked about was the historically black college and university tradition, where we show off the flair of our musicality and improvisatorial aspect of it by always keeping the beat, but showing how you can flip the beat, get on front of it, get on the back end of it, and always catch up to it.
And you know, Jeremy, I noticed that Amari was the drum went from his knees up to his head. So I wondered, how heavy are those drums? And was he hurting his back there having to carry that thing?
You know, Amari, he is so energetic and excited to play the drums. You won't even know if he's in pain. But I will say, personally, picking up those drums, they are pretty heavy.
They're heavy.
But the way that they perform it, you wouldn't even have an idea.
Yeah, before you go, though, we've said, Brian O'Donovan, our colleague, who's done brilliant work promoting local music everywhere, as great as that sound was, seeing players do it is like a whole different... It's just like you're so drawn into the music and the people. They were fabulous. They look fabulous. They sound fabulous. So congratulations on that, too.
Thank
Marjorie's
going
to say how to get tickets in a minute, but it sounds like a fabulous show. We'd urge everybody to go. And if you want more of Dr. Price, he'll be on some radio show Monday morning in Boston. It's great
we'll
to meet you, Jeremy.
We'll see if I get to talk then.
We'll get to see you, Jeremy.
thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in. That was a great treat. So, of course, we've been speaking, listening to the folks of the Hamilton Garrett Center of Music and Art, for Music and Arts, rather, an after-school nonprofit fostering creativity and talent among the kids of Roxbury and Greater Boston. For more information and to get tickets to Sunday's show, go to hamiltongarrett.org, two R's and two T's, and Garrett, hamiltongarrett.org, HAMILTONGARRETT, or berkeley.edu/BPC. So after a quick break, our friend Arthur Brooks, Harvard professor and author of The Atlantic's How to Lead a Happy Life column, had one good one recently. Happiness, he said, is a warm cup of coffee. We talked yesterday with Corby Kummer about Starbucks in Italy putting olive oil in espressos as a marketing gimmick. We want to know about your coffee habits, how you like yours, and the shell of a person you would be without your cup of coffee. That's 877-301-8970. After a quick break, 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live at the Boston Public Library. Streaming on YouTube.com/GBH News and at Facebook.com/GBH News. As we mentioned at the top of the show, this is the 10th anniversary of Boston Public Radio. At 2 o'clock, we will cut the cake. So if you're here, stick around. And if you're not, maybe you want to come by. Closing out the show, though, we're opening the phone and text lines. What does a cup of coffee mean to you? It means quite a bit to Arthur Brooks. Arthur is a contributor to The Atlantic, a regular guest on our show. He writes about it like it's his first love. Maybe a few of you can relate. I can. And importantly, and this bears some weight coming from him, it actually makes you happy. It improves cognition, gets you to be more active, which in turn releases endorphins. It's truly, as Arthur writes, a boon to humanity. He says every day he renews his vows with the bean, is the way he put it. So closing the show, we want to know at 877-301-8970, does coffee do for you what it does for me and Arthur Brooks and Marjorie to an extent? Is that first cup of coffee your reason for getting out of bed in the morning? And if you have a special trick for making the perfect cup? Yesterday, Marjorie and Andrea were talking to Corby Kummer about a marketing gimmick that Starbucks is using in Italy where they're putting olive oil in their espresso.
Yeah,
would you try that? And as you probably know, the FDA decided just yesterday that oat milk and almond milk can still be called milk over Big Dairy's objections. So how do you take your coffee so that you can reach that feeling of exaltation? 877-301-8970. How about you, Marjorie?
Well, I love coffee. I mean, I may not drink as much as you, but I do love coffee. And as Arthur Brooks points out in his piece in The Atlantic, you know, coffee does make you happy. A low dose of caffeine can lead to a significant increase in happiness and calmness and decreases tenseness. It can also improve your cognitive performance, which means it can make you smarter. So with exercise and coffee, the two together can really enhance your reaction time and your logical reasoning abilities. So coffee, I mean, we have these studies from time to time say it's going to do bad things to your stomach or whatever, but I think overall, I agree with them. the holy power, Jim, of the bean.
Yeah, but I have to say, it's great, the cognitive thing and all these other scientific things. It's, for me at least, and you know I've said this to you 1,000 times, it's the joy of being alone, even with a cup of coffee, like on a nice day outside. Isn't that about as good as it gets? Yes?
No, I like the buzz. I'm in it
well,
for the buzz.
You're in for the sign of the buzz.
Yeah, okay. I'm in it for the buzz because it definitely does. And when you get tired.
I'm in for the feeling.
Okay, you're in for the feeling.
Yeah.
But if you are tired, I mean, there's nothing like having an espresso, right? It just wakes you. It wakes you right up. And if you're working and you, especially around 3:30 in the afternoon, especially when I used to write for a living, you're getting tired, you have a cup of coffee. Better yet, an espresso, and you are wired.
So you don't experience the joy, that kind of thing, from coffee?
Well, that's fine. Don't you drink like 10 cups of coffee a day?
Do.
And plus,
I do.
You say that you could drink a cup of coffee at 10 o'clock and go to sleep.
Go to sleep right away.
Yeah, see, I don't want to drink too much coffee. I think of it as the buzz to get to get the buzz from, the caffeine high from, so I don't want to drink coffee.
So
I
for
drink
Margaret,
coffee,
it's like a science
o'clock.
Experiment. For me, it's like an emotional
moment.
Well,
it's
a
drug.
It's
a drug. It's a legal drug, and, you know, I take advantage of all legal drugs from time to time.
Even when some of them were illegal. Do you know what I mean?
I wouldn't know anything
877-301-8970. Margaret and I are on different tracks. I want people to celebrate the joy of a cup of coffee. And by the way, one thing we're not doing today, because I can't take it anymore, we're not doing one of these iced coffee versus hot coffee things. We do that once a year. Today is not the day for it. I don't want to hear anybody tell me how iced coffee is the greatest. A hot cup of coffee in your hand, even on a hot day, is as exciting, almost erotic, as practically. I'm serious. Why is Jamie laughing? To each his own. Everybody's got a different deal, Jamie.
Because Jamie says he's fallen asleep holding onto the coffee mug, spilling it all over himself.
He
so he doesn't,
that,
doesn't have quite the same effect
Let's
on Jamie,
calls.
Maybe, as it does on you, Jim.
Let's go to Valerie. She's in Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Valerie. Welcome.
Alexa, mute.
Hello?
Are you there?
Hi.
Yes. Well, yes, I'm here.
We know that. Hi.
Hi. So I've always really been into coffee.
Yeah.
But about a year or so ago, I got into pour-over coffee.
That's good.
Which is the idea, the notion of doing it is very simple. You grind your coffee, and you have to grind it if you're going to do it right. You grind your coffee beans. You put them in a filter in a cone. You take water from a kettle, and you pour it over.
Yeah.
And that notion is so simple, and it gives you amazing coffee. But to do it great takes a lot of practice, and there's all kinds of technique to it. You can go down a rabbit hole. There's a million videos you can watch. Like, everyone's got these special recipes for it. But on mornings when you make a really exceptional cup of coffee, it's like, oh, it just makes you feel so good. Like,
oh, yeah.
You're starting off the day amazingly.
You know, Valerie, thanks for calling. She made a wonderful point. Do you remember, Marjorie, a bunch of years ago, I think it was the first time, what's the head of Starbucks' his name?
Schultz.
Schultz. Howard Schultz. When Howard Schultz is now on his third time as CEO, when he was the first time CEO, do you remember they started grinding beans not in the stores, but at some central
People
location? The profits dropped dramatically. Why?
Because
the smell of coffee being ground is part of the joy of the experience, as Valerie explained beautifully a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah, a lot of people are talking about the fact that they put their coffee together. Now, the only time I drink black coffee is after I've had a big meal. Mm. Otherwise, I put milk in it. How about you?
What is that about?
Milk?
What? No. I said, why after a big meal?
Because somehow black coffee and an empty stomach makes me think I need some kind of coating in there, you know what I mean, in my stomach.
I think I do know what you mean.
Yeah, so I put a lot of milk in. And I think a lot of women, you know, you're not supposed to drink coffee when you're pregnant, of course. So years ago when I had babies, I didn't want to drink too much coffee. So I may have an inch of coffee and then like 3 inches of milk and heat it all up. And so that's kind of stayed with me, a lot of milk and coffee.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, let me just tell you.
Because
you're not into this.
I'm into it.
No, you're not.
I'm into the buzz from coffee. Why do you think
I'm alone?
I don't think I'm alone.
If I start talking about sitting on a street in Paris at a cafe, you're going to ridicule me?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so this is a place called Rue Claire, which is admittedly a little touristy. Every seat at the cafe faces the street. You sit there with a cafe au lait or something, and you watch people go. I mean, it's really It's look at her. Okay, forget that. I mean, really. Paula in Cambridge.
There are some people that think that, too. Lori from Rhode Island says, coffee is my reason for getting out of bed, a perfect pour-over. I sit and enjoy my coffee
exactly.
with my three cats on my lap before I start the day. And I told you how I was. I forget where I saw this, but I saw this little sign somewhere in the last few days.
Oh, this is great, yeah.
And it said, it was by a coffee machine, and it said, first coffee.
I love that.
And I like that. So
first
before,
comma coffee.
What?
First comma coffee?
Yep, first coffee. So in other words, before you have a conversation, before you begin your day, before you meet with whoever you're going to meet with, first coffee.
Let's go to Paula in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm in a cult. It's called Barista Milk.
Wait, say that again.
I'm in a cult.
Yeah.
It's Barista Oat Milk.
Okay.
There are a couple of brands of it. A lifetime of half and half, I'm off it. In order to get the milk out of the oats, they roast it. So it's a roasted milk with roast coffee, and it's unbelievably healthy. I'm never going back.
Now, wait
Listen
a minute,
to
wait
the
a
joy
minute.
In her
Hold
voice,
on.
Marjorie.
Are you talking about making your coffee with oat milk, or is there some special formula you're talking about?
There's a special oat milk formula. There are two brands I know of called Barista Oat Milk.
Barista Oat Milk.
One of
our
coworkers said that too, yeah.
You can foam it.
Oh, maybe
you
I should try that.
It. You can have it hot as cafe au lait. If I don't see it, I go nuts and I can look everywhere.
So
Paula, how important is this in your life? Maybe you can convey to Marjorie the joy that she doesn't feel.
It's the most important thing in my day. And, in fact, nobody's going to mess with my coffee. I'm going to have half and half if I want it all my life, and I've changed.
Paula, can you buy it at the supermarket, or is it?
Yes.
You can?
Oh, yeah. They have it at not just, like, Whole Foods. They have it at Stop and Shop. They have it.
Wow. I've never
Sometimes
seen it.
It is a shelf-stable thing. Sometimes it's in the dairy case, I think, because people look for creamers there.
Oh, okay.
But if you look at it, it says open, you know, refrigerate after opening. It's unbelievable.
Hey, Paula, do you ever think about how odd it is that you know so much about this?
Yes, and I bore people with it all.
No, you're not boring us at all. But, Paula, thank you for the call.
You know, we're getting recipes for people.
Well, let's read one or two.
This is from Emily. Grande almond milk latte with one pump unsweetened vanilla and one pump peppermint. Starbucks order of the elite.
You get the vanilla pumped into your stuff here at the New
I do.
Cafe.
I like,
where they
I,
have great
I like,
coffee,
I like
the way.
The sweetness with oat milk. Yeah, I get oat milk too, but I didn't know about this barista oat milk, so I'm going to try that.
So they just sent us a picture of California Farms Oat Barista Blend. And we also have somebody at the mic in the library who apparently, unfortunately, is going to make the case for iced coffee. We'll make the exception just for you. I believe your name is Seth. Is that correct?
Correct.
Hi,
Seth. We're going to crush you like a bug, but give it a try. Go ahead.
Well, I have two comments. First of all, my dad cannot get through the day. My dad, Mike, cannot get through the day without his coffee, which is always caffeinated.
Okay.
And what he says is that he'll get anyone that comes between him and his coffee.
That's beautiful spirit. That's a wonderful spirit.
Yes.
Let's talk about you, Seth. What's your deal?
What I wanted to say was that iced coffee, I don't usually have it, but iced coffee is the best by far.
And why is that?
Because I say so.
Okay, fine. That was an excellent argument on behalf of your father and you, Seth. Thank you for your contribution. That was pretty good reasoning, I think.
Listen to this. My kids tease me that my usually suppressed Boston accent comes out when I order at the Dunkin' drive-thru. Medium iced coffee, cream, one sugar.
That was pretty good by you.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to Alan in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hey, guys.
Hey.
The best cup of coffee is the one that your significant other makes first thing in the morning.
That's pretty good.
To you as you get out of bed.
That's pretty good.
That can't be beat.
Yeah, that's true. Somebody else, here's somebody that agrees with this. This is Amy from Newton. She says, my husband brews me my morning coffee every day. I do look forward to it both for the aroma and taste, but also because it's a loving routine. Isn't
is that your
nice?
Deal, Alan, or what? Or you just want somebody else to make it for you?
No, I like it better when my wife makes it. And yeah, to be honest with you, I make her coffee every day before.
Sure you do.
Like when I leave, coffee's ready for her when she gets up.
Well, that's a nice. So. That's actually a nice thing. Alan, thank you. I enjoy the making of the thing too, as some people have said. It's a whole ritual kind of deal, and you end up with this beautiful, dark brown cup of fabulous beverage.
I have an espresso machine now.
I know you do. Do you know how to use it?
It was a wedding present to my daughter. She didn't want to like
it. Why did she give it to you?
She didn't have room.
Well, you also bought one of those Nespressos to work, which you've never used once.
Well, it broke.
Oh, well, that's one of
the reasons. Yeah, but you can get the frother to go with it, and then you can, you know, froth up the milk and pour it into the espresso and put some sugar in there, and it's really
a wonderful thing. So let me ask you that one more thing. If you, let's assume you don't need a buzz. You leave the radio show at 2 o'clock on a beautiful spring day in a month. You would not consider just going to a cafe or coffee shop and sitting outside and looking at people?
Well, I guess I would, but I'm always afraid if I drink too much coffee that it will, I'll not get the buzz anymore. I want it to make me, I want it to wake me up when I'm feeling tired. Huh. And I think if you drink too much coffee, it doesn't keep you awake, obviously.
No, it doesn't.
If you have it at 10 o'clock, I want the coffee to keep me awake. So that's my deal. Bruce in Brookline, thank you for calling.
Welcome. Bruce. Okay.
Hi, how
Bruce,
are you?
Bruce, have a cup of coffee and then, oh, you're there.
No, I didn't know I was on.
You're on.
Yeah, thank you. I want to sort of give a shout out to, it's a Gloucester-based company that I was super skeptical of. They make, it's called Cometeer, Comet, E-E-R, and it's these frozen, they come frozen, and it's changed my life. I was a French press snob, and I love it. It comes out to probably a buck and a half for a cup, probably the most amazing cup of coffee I've ever made at home.
Wait a minute. Say it again.
I'm with you. Yeah.
What's it called?
Cometeer.
Oh, Cometeer?
Cometeer. C-O-M-E. Yeah, they're based in Gloucester. And it's an amazing, the best coffee I've ever had. It comes frozen in these pods. I thought it was going to be like one of those Keurig things that I hate and think is abominable. But it's really changed my life. Like, it's the best. It's super fast. I just pull it out of the freezer and pull close to boiling water over it, and it's the most amazing cup of coffee.
Now, Bruce,
that they process it.
How about AeroPress? I was into AeroPress for quite some time.
What is that?
It's like a little single-serving coffee.
You said that to me.
Yeah, you can just push it down, little plunger kind of deal. I think that's really
good. Bruce, do you own the company or no?
Yeah.
Tell the truth.
I don't. Okay. I don't at all, I promise.
Okay.
Okay, C-O-M-E-T-E-R.
It's on our screen right now. Our colleagues put it up there.
Oh, okay.
Cometeer.
I have to try that,
so,
too.
So, Bruce, let me try it with you, really since I'm not eliciting what I'm attempting to elicit from callers. How much, I can hear the joy in your voice. How much does that cup of coffee mean to you?
Oh, it's a fresh brewed cup of coffee in the morning is like the way I start my day. I know I'm probably an addict, but it does it for me. And I have to agree with you. I'm not pandering. Iced coffee is not coffee to me.
I am beautifully put on that note, Bruce. Thank you
now,
for the call.
Jim, one of the texters has noted that you have a fondness. It's not clear which one you're more fond of, your coffee or your Q-tips.
We're not going to do an erotic Q-tip story today.
Well,
we're just not.
Mike from Leland, North Carolina says, Jim, the only thing better than a good cup of coffee is a good cup of coffee
with a Q-tip.
With your Q-tip in your ear.
Okay, fine. We're not
and
doing
Paul
this today.
From Worcester says, How does he take his coffee? He takes it, of course, in a smug mug.
Ba-dum-bum.
So there you go.
You know, speaking of smug mug, we only have a couple minutes left, and I think we have to acknowledge the fact that we've mentioned a few times this is the 10th anniversary of this show.
Yes, I know. We're very lucky.
We are lucky, and we're going to be serving cake from Flower Bakery. Joanne Chang's maybe the best baker
with my coffee.
Lived. With your coffee,
right here.
Exactly.
Yep.
What we thought we'd do is our colleagues went back. Do you remember we tried out? After we were, Marjorie doesn't like it when I say we were fired at the other station.
We were. They flipped to a radio station.
They flipped to hip-hop.
And we lost our job.
Lost all of us.
I was in a total panic.
We were hired here, but first we had to do a tryout.
I was going to move out of state.
And a sort of filling in kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Here is a little bit from what we call the billboard. That's at the beginning of the show when we tell you what we're going to talk about during the show. Here's a little excerpt from January of 2013. This is before we were actually hired.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy. For the next 2 hours, we're going to be occupying the WGBH airwaves on a special edition of Boston Public Radio.
We are, Jim, but don't get too comfortable in that chair, you know what I mean? He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. We are filling in today live on 89.7 Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
And Marjorie, the long national nightmare is over. We are back on the radio.
I don't think most people view it as a long national nightmare, Jim.
Okay, maybe not. Okay, so we were horrible. Is that a phase? We were really bad. Yeah,
well,
we got hired anyway, which is pretty incredible.
The thing is, you know, I've been working for a tabloid for like 25 years, the Boston Herald, and somehow the Boston Herald and WGBH, you know, people don't think of them as kind of the same sort of thing. So I knew that people were horrified that they were hiring someone from the Boston Herald, even considering it to be on their rarefied air. And the kind of low-rent stuff that we used to do in the radio gym, you can't do.
Right, if you think
station.
We're low-rent now, you didn't listen to the old radio show on commercial radio. The story that I remember, I've told this to you and elsewhere a lot of times, there was a legendary member of the board of directors who shall remain unnamed.
That's right.
I don't know if she wants us to tell the story attached to her. About 6 months after we were hired, we were finally hired, I'm coming out of the men's room on the first floor, and this woman is there, and she says, "Are you Jim Browdy?" I say, "Yeah." And she said, "I'd like to." I said, "Who are you?" She says, "I'm so-and-so. I'm on the board of directors here at GBH." And she shows me an email that she sent to our then CEO, John Abbott, on the day we were hired, which essentially says, and I'm not being hyperbolic, "You have just made the biggest mistake in the history of GBH. Not only are they atrocious, but their atrociousness will taint everything on GBH.
We were going to taint GBH."
And so I said to this woman, this is a true story, it actually is a heartwarming story for me, I said, "So why are you giving me this note?" And you know what she said to me, Marjorie? "I'm here to apologize."
Yeah, she changed her
mind. So it's about 6 months. We've been really lucky. We've really been lucky to be here all these times. Do you have a memory you want to share quickly?
Well, just that you get to talk to great people for like 20 minutes, and people that you wouldn't normally get to talk to because the power of this, the name of WGBH. Now we're just plain old GBH, but it's
three governors, three mayors,
so well respected, so beloved of the community, does such a great job. It's a high end operation, and you know, we finally made it to a high end operation, Jim. It took a long time, but we finally did.
And no one thought we would last, and frankly, neither did we. So we thank every listener. We thank our bosses here at GBH, the board. It's been a wonderful 10 years, and we hope there are many more. So stick around. Cake in 3 minutes and 37
Very
seconds.
Very excited about that.
Now you're going to tell people what's coming up tomorrow.
Yes, I am. I appreciate everybody for listening today to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I appreciate the people that
came
down to the library.
It
makes us very happy that you show up down here. If you haven't got enough of us, you can listen to us 24/7. We have our podcast. On Monday, we're going to have a special panel, two Ukrainians living in Boston. We've had them on the show a number of times. We're going to check in with them on the anniversary of the horrible invasion of Ukraine by Russia. We'll also be joined by Media Matters for America's for America, the president of that organization, Angelo Carusone. He's who's going to talk about Fox News lying about the presidential election, which I can't wait to hear. Food policy analyst Corby Kummer. The Rev's Ira Munroe and Emma G. Price III was just here. Can't get enough of it. He's going to be back on Monday. And inaugural poet Richard Blanco for another edition of Village Voice. We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss. Our engineer is John Claw Parker with Brian Bell on the boards. Our executive producer is Jenny Bologna. We want to give special thanks today to the BPL team. Sandra Lopez-Burke for bringing in the cakes. We thank her very much. Sai Patel and Brad Lewis. Thank you all very much.
And by the way, it's been great working with you, I should say. Not just 10 years here, but almost 25 years on the radio overall.
I know it.
It's
unbelievable,
it's incredible.
Jim. You know what? I'm going to get an award.
For tolerating me. Sadly, she's not kidding. Thank you so much, everybody. Stick around for the cake. We'll be back. It's today, Friday. On Monday, I'm Jim Browdy.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Thank you again for tuning in today, and thank you for the support for this show for all these 10 years. We really, really appreciate it. Hope you have a great weekend. Hope you can tune again on Monday.